So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review me.
Ricky Steamboat, Randy Savage, WrestleMania 3. Bret Hart, Owen Hart, WrestleMania 10. The legendary wars between Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat. But nothing, and I mean nothing, comes close to comparing to what we see here from the Tokyo Dome. Oh my goodness, he's going for Marketing Backbreaker Rack. It's a burning hammer. There it is, the burning hammer.
That's gonna be it.
Signature move. This has to be it.
It's gotta be one,
two, three.
Unbelievable! Kobashi retains the title, his seventh.
Amazing.
His ninth successful title defense. And a classic.
Absolutely astounding match there with the burning hammer. That's one of Kobashi's biggest finishing moves. A great finish. Akiyama, look.
In the annals of Puro Wrestle history.
Here we go.
Chavis
down
as one of the best ever. The burning hammer.
Burning hammer.
In the 1-2-3, Kobashi retains the GHC Heavyweight Championship.
Welcome to Review Away. It's John Pollock and Wei Ting with you for another edition of Review Away. How are you doing, Mr. Ting?
Doing great.
We are going to have quite a lot of fun, I think, on this show. It is a very unique show. So, Wei, you kind of came up with this idea. So what are the listeners in store for over the next 6 hours?
Well, if you've been listening to our podcast for the last little while, I think a lot of people probably get the sense that I'm just really bored and really tired of watching full wrestling match.
I've been scared cards to pick wrestling cards for 2 months now.
And my biggest complaint, of course, is just that, I mean, often there are these shows that I think we really look forward to for one event or one moment in it, and, you know, that's usually the main event or something of that nature. But so just having to sit through a lot of the bullshit undercards, it's just, to me, not the greatest use of both of our times, nor the listeners' time. So instead, we decided this week to do a bit of a compilation review, and a compilation kind of our choosing. The news this past couple of weeks was the retirement, of course, of Kenta Kobashi. And so, you know, I've followed his career, but really more so recently, and more so his recent matches. So I a lot of his matches I actually had not seen, and I was genuinely interested to see some of the other matches throughout his career, including his retirement match that just occurred. So we decided to review four of his best matches, all rated 5 stars from the Wrestling Observer, but four of them from four different eras of his life.
Yeah, trying to kind of basically take a kind of a snapshot of his entire career with four very distinct time periods within his career, both you know, really just getting his first big significant push in 1990 up until you know, one of his classic matches with his most famous rival, I think we'd both agree, with Mitsuharu Misawa.
Yeah.
Into his Noah career during the middle of, I think, his most famous title run, that with the GHC title that he held for 2 years, and then the retirement match that just happened earlier this month.
Yeah, and there certainly was no shortage of great matches to choose from, but I mean, I mentioned that they're not all except the last one. The last one is not a 5-star match, but I mean, we chose that for historical purposes, right? But as far as 5-star matches go, there was no shortage to choose from.
This he's been given. Dave Meltzer has awarded 23 5-star ratings to Kenta Kobashi's matches over the years, which is just unbelievably incredible.
Second only to Misawa.
Yeah, so we're going to be chatting about a lot of that. Plus, we have two guests on today's show. Mm-hmm. We're going to be joined by W.H. Park, who you are familiar with from Japanese audio wrestling, and the man who I really credit with as my drug dealer when it came to Japanese wrestling and hooking me up with this shit. and done very much in the same way as kind of drug deals are done. Very secretive, done with, you know, tapes and alleyways being distributed. This is what wrestling fans did for Japanese wrestling. It wasn't as shady as I make it sound. But nonetheless, I had read about all these names so many years in both, you know, Pro Wrestling Illustrated. That's when I first heard these names. Then the Wrestling Observer newsletter kind of got me more into kind of the business side of things and just reading more about these performers. But it was really through WH and Dan Lavransky that I actually got to see these guys and then started ordering tapes myself and getting to see a lot of these names projected on the screen and actually see their work.
Mm-hmm. You know, this was an era before the internet, so all the stuff you had to know somebody in real life to get this VHS.
Yeah, and that's something that, I mean, I talked about this when we interviewed Blue Meanie on WrestleMania weekend, the fact that, you know, you and I are still from a generation where you really had to work hard to get some of this stuff. And mm-hmm. I remember the first time I ever ordered any tapes, it was through High Spots for the Best of the Super Juniors tournament, for the J Cup, the 95 J Cup. And I had to wait 6 weeks for those fucking VHS tapes to come. And when they came, God, was I excited.
Exactly.
I came home from school, there was a big package, and I opened it, and it was this blue case with the VHS in it, written in basic font, Super J Cup, Parts 1 and 2.
And what a great feeling that must have been. I mean, compare that to these days where, okay, I want to watch the J Cup, I'm going to hit YouTube and type in Super J Cup, and then you get it. You might get it at a convenience, but you don't value it as much.
No, the want is not there. The journey to get it is not there.
No.
It's the waiting period.
It's all about the chase.
Exactly. It is all about the chase.
Yeah.
Life is one big pay-per-view you're building towards.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking of a chase in like another way, but yeah. That makes sense.
We're also going to be joined on the show by our former Fight Network colleague, Mauro Ranallo, who, of course, you posted the match last week, Way, of Kenta Kobashi versus Jun Akiyama, which Fight Network had a relationship with Pro Wrestling Noah at the time, and we were airing Noah, which Way produced, and Dan Lavransky and Mauro Ranallo called these shows, and in particular, the Kobashi-Akiyama match from the Tokyo Dome, which we're reviewing today. Perhaps one of, if not the biggest match I think Noah ever presented. It was a 5-star match at the time, their first time in the Tokyo Dome. And in particular, Moro's call of that match has been, Dave Meltzer raved about it because he got a copy of the show, but it's really never been outside of those that saw it at the time on Fight Network have had a chance to see. And just in this past week, Way, tons of people have been talking about it. Jim Ross tweeted out the link, and was just, mm-hmm. Probably the first time he ever got to see Moro call a wrestling match.
Yeah, it's one of those things, and we'll talk about it a bit more, especially with Moro, but one of those things that I think everybody associates Moro so much with MMA and now boxing that they don't think that somebody doing actual sports could be successful or even, you know, in Moro's case, have been brought up in pro wrestling. And if you get a chance to watch that match with his commentary and Mouth, who does a great job, you'll really understand that part of the reason why he probably is so good at what he does today is in large part due to his background as a pro wrestling announcer.
So we're going to kind of just go through kind of Kobashi with kind of, you know, some bullet points on his career. And then as we get to each match, we'll kind of go through those as well. So not really any big structure to all of this. But I'm curious, Wade, when you first heard of Kenta Kobashi, did you get a lot of like Pro Wrestling Illustrated magazines? Or
no.
When did you first hear the name?
I mean, my awakening to the underground of pro wrestling probably came, you know, once I started listening to The Law, once I got on the internet and message boards and whatnot. And at that point, I just all of a sudden heard about this, wrestlers from Japan. And the name Kenta Kobashi, Mitsuharu Misawa, Jushin Liger, all those names would come up. And so that's how I heard about it. Eventually, I got into news groups. And that's when I really started to download a lot of different wrestling matches from around the world. And, Kobashi, Misawa, Kawada, like those were the names at the time.
Yeah, I remember there was this file sharing program called Kazaa that came out in the wake of Napster. Mm-hmm. And I remember being able to find all these Japanese matches and yet to download them, which sometimes would take me like I'd have to download it like at 11 p.m. and then come back the next morning.
Yeah.
And it's crashed and I'd have to wait another day to record it. I had a horrible connection even then with my internet.
Did it ever happen with you where like you would download something and like
And it was a fucking troll video or something? Yeah, that always happens.
Where would be would, like, you know, title something like that you really want.
They put, like, a fucking, like, 35-minute video up, and it's just fucking nothing. Like, who would have the time to do something like that? Like, that is an asshole.
Yeah.
That's an asshole who's going out of their way to waste your time.
That's somebody who should be actually arrested.
Yeah, I would absolutely
forget the people that steal. It's the trolls who should be put to jail.
Did you ever have any worries back in that time period? And, like, with everything involving Napster, there was a big scare tactic designed that. And I remember always saying to myself, "Oh, well, it's illegal to upload, but not to download." So I don't know what I'm doing.
Was that the case? Really? Because once you're downloading, you're actually uploading, aren't you? Like, there's like a ratio. There's like a share ratio, don't you?
Yeah, I didn't know the mechanics of how it all worked. I
wasn't that concerned.
Yeah. I there was a time period when I actually, like, saw, like, news reports of, like, fucking, like, uploaders and shit being arrested and stuff. And I was like, holy fuck,
Metallica.
Man, maybe this, maybe all these programs or all these, songs and stuff I have on my computer I should really avoid.
I think I just always considered myself safe because I wasn't really a Metallica fan at the time and just stayed away from downloading Metallica.
That was such a big story at the time with Metallica. It turned a lot of people off of Metallica the time. It was amazing.
I mean, in hindsight, did it really do that much? No.
Yep.
And I understand Lars. I understand why he'd be upset.
Yeah,
people are stealing.
I always remember when Kid Rock was on, like, Much Music or something, and they asked him about his thoughts on it, and he's like, "Fuck it, I'm rich." That was his beautiful analysis of it. Yeah, it's true. Anyway, so Kenta Kobashi, basically, he had a really interesting introduction into professional wrestling because he came from high school where he did, like, rugby, he did baseball, but wasn't, like, a high-class wrestler or, you know, an elite athlete, which a lot of these wrestling companies at the time, New Japan, All Japan, were recruiting and finding. And a lot of it would be, you know, guys that would go up for the Olympic wrestling team, like a Jun Akiyama, for instance, or coming out of it like a Jumbo Tsuruta. Kobashi didn't necessarily have that sports pedigree behind him, but when he went to All Japan, they turned him down at first. They weren't interested in him. And basically, from that time, he went back to the gym, just bulked up, and just worked like a madman at the gym. And then one of his trainers went straight to Giant Baba and showed him some photos. And I don't think Giant Baba was the one who made the ruling of turning this guy around, but Baba kind of saw something in him, brought him in just for the opportunity to be trained by All Japan. Because if you've ever seen the Gaia Girls documentary, I mean, that was kind of the environment in Japan, was that you didn't simply just show up and, oh, we'll put you on TV or something. It was like they weeded people out where it was like a very tiny percentage would get the opportunity to be employed by a company. They had extremely high standards.
I'm just trying to envision a skinny Kenta Kobashi. You mentioned that he hit the gym really hard. And
well, I'm sure he was, not looking like you or I, but nonetheless, I'm sure he, certainly smaller than he would be. I mean, he was a very, he was like 280 pounds.
And that's small?
No, I'm saying he would. That was his size throughout his career.
Yeah, yeah. But that's very interesting. I mean, what could have been, right?
So anyway, he was brought into All Japan, trained under a man by the name of Kazuhiro Sanada, who would actually die a couple of months later in a plane crash in just a crazy story.
Couple months after what?
After he started training Kobashi.
Oh, okay.
And this was the story in the Wrestling Observer newsletter, was that the great Kabuki offered his mask to Sanada to go do a show overseas with his wife, and essentially they could get a honeymoon. He could work as the great Kabuki on this overseas tour and then come back, and it would be kind of Kabuki wouldn't be working it, but people would think they saw Kabuki. On his way there, the plane goes down and he dies.
Wow.
And people had thought Kabuki was on the airplane, but it was actually this trainer, Sanada, that died. Just one of those strange, bizarre stories that only wrestling could really produce, where a guy was impersonating another wrestler going on this plane that ultimately took his life.
That's very tragic.
Kobashi's first match came in late 1987, and then he would debut officially in 1988, and they brought him in with kind of what they brought in with a lot of Japanese wrestlers, where it was just pretty much you don't have any gimmicks. You're just a basic wrestler. And he went on the 63-match losing streak where mm-hmm. it would be kind of the story that would take years to play out where you follow this guy from day one, slowly working his way up.
And it seemed to work out for him. And, you know, often we complain these days about WWE bringing in guys and jobbing them out. Guys like Antonio Cesaro, maybe this is what they're
maybe they have a 10-year plan with yeah. Antonio Cesaro.
Okay, you got a job up to 63 matches. You're at about, I don't know, 30, and you're halfway there. And then you'll become a big star.
So there you go. Maybe they have many Kenta Kobashis in the 1988-89
Zack Ryder is stage. Getting ready for that two-year title run.
Yeah, his first official victory came in match 64, against an American wrestler by the name of Mitch Snow.
Wow.
A very a trivia note in the history of Kenta Kobashi.
He's still alive. I'd love to talk to this man.
No, he's not. Yeah, he's no longer with us. Oh. So, and then pretty much we fast forward to where our first match that we're going to review takes place. And that was where a big shift took place in 1990 because one of the major stars of All Japan Pro Wrestling at the time, Jinichiro Tenryu, he was lured away by this giant eyeglass manufacturer that decided we want to start a pro wrestling promotion. And that was the forming of SWS, which would later have a relationship with the WWF.
Like glasses, you mean?
Eyeglasses. Like that was the business.
Eyeglasses?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Because they could see a future with pro wrestling, and hindsight being 2020, it didn't quite work out for them. Using Tenryu as their main star, and they took him from All Japan.
What's the thought behind that? Because, I mean, when you wrestle, you can't wear glasses. I mean, it should be a wrestling organization where everybody has to wear glasses.
Well, this is really no different than, like, Panda Energy running TNA Impact Wrestling, knowing that a lot of energy resources are being spent on these massive television tapings.
They should have matches where the goal is to break your opponent's glasses or have two like nearly blind.
There's no honor in hitting a man with glasses.
Fine. Two nearly glasses on a pole. You go for the glasses and then the person. It's like a blindfold match almost.
That sounds ridiculous maybe 10 years ago, but after the pole matches we've seen over the past decade or so, Wade, that's not even the most ridiculous. I've seen a syringe on a pole match in wrestling. That's a future review.
How did that work out?
It was Buff Bagwell and David Flair, and they were trying to determine who had impregnated, I believe, Stacy Keibler.
And what is this? Is the purpose of
the syringe on a pole was to, I think, the loser would have to take a blood test to see if they were the father. This is a very sketchy period in WCW.
Like in the match?
Afterwards. That would be crazy, Wade.
You would syringe your opponent to get a blood sample.
Yeah.
To end the match.
We're going to have to go back. At some point, I'm going to have to stomach it and go back to WCW 2000.
Okay. Quite the jump from All Japan.
From Kenta Kobashi in the 1990 period. But at that time, still really the flag bearer for All Japan Pro Wrestling was Jumbo Tsuruta, who was revered by many as one of the greatest pro wrestlers of all time. And just a couple of weeks ago, I had just watched this match from June of 1990 involving Jumbo Tsuruta and Mitsuharu Misawa. And Misawa was kind of the same. He was this young wrestler coming up, but hadn't really won the big one. And they were doing this show, I believe it was at Budokan Hall. And that night, the crowd was just electric for this match, and Dave Meltzer was at this show, and he was talking about this on his radio show a couple of weeks ago, that during the show, they made the call that instead of Tsuruta, Misawa was going to win this match tonight, and he won this match. This place went insane, because this was the sign that this Misawa has now beaten the master in Jumbo Tsuruta, and it led to this incredible business period for All Japan, where they would just sell out something like their next 200 events, and their three key figures of elevating new talent was Misawa, Toshiaki Kawada, and then to a lesser extent, Kenta Kobashi, who I think most people would slot in the number three position amongst those three. But in this first match we're reviewing, Wei, it's the three kind of young up-and-coming students taking on Jumbo Tsuruta, Masafuchi, and Akira Taue, who was also very much a part of that group as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, the first thing, I don't know about you, John, but the first thing I always notice when I watch these All Japan matches is just the color scheme that belonged to all these individual wrestlers. I mean, I think when you think of All Japan, you can't help but think of, you know, the colors attributed to each of the wrestlers. Misawa wearing green, Taue with the black and yellow, and of course Kenta Kobashi with the orange. And Akira Taue with the red, Jun Akiyama with the blue. Like, I just... I always loved that visual of just, you know, one color versus the other. It's so basic and so simple, but it really works.
I always loved that idea. And, I mean, even today with New Japan Pro Wrestling, they always want to present these characters with these vibrant colors and just, like, top-notch ring gear that really does separate them from, you know, I couldn't have imagined, you know, Kenta Kobashi coming out with, like, ripped jeans, you know what I mean, and performing in them.
It's a different world. I mean, you know, what, even 1989, like, you compare that to a lot of what you see in North America, even at the time, and I've always found like the Japanese presentation of pro wrestling to be much more sport-like. They, you know, down to the way that they would do interviews, it wasn't really like cutting a promo. I'm gonna beat you. They would be fielding questions like a hockey player, and some people might find that kind of boring, but for me, it added authenticity.
So this match took place October 19th of 1990. So a couple of months removed from that really big match with Tsuruta and Misawa, which was really the jump start for kind of positioning Misawa in this light. And that was evident in this match way. When Misawa got tagged in, specifically when him and Tsuruta mm-hmm. interacted, there was just this unbelievable buzz throughout the arena here. Just seeing Misawa here at such a young age, who he was clearly, I think, positioned at this point as he is the focal point.
Was there, I never really understood completely whether or not there was a concept of a babyface versus a heel group. I mean, in this match itself, what did you take out of it?
I took it to be, it was much less defined of babyfaces and heels, but you certainly got the effect here that these are the three young, hungry lions mm-hmm. trying to essentially knock off the establishment of led by Jumbo Tsuruta and Tsuruta's army. And it was just, to me, it was always subtle heel babyface, where it wasn't anything overt, but I think that people naturally were going to get behind these young talents who are all trying to rise within the pecking order of All Japan Pro Wrestling, and it playing out over a several month and even year process for these three, and kind of watching them evolve and go up. I mean, hilarious to watch this, and kind of this was kind of the same concept that WCW tried to have with the Millionaires Club and the new blood. Remember that?
Yes, I do. Yeah, pretty different.
If only Jumbo Tsuruta could have played the Hulk Hogan role with the black leather and pulling a gun on somebody. That period's
that
a blur.
Worked.
That's the last WCW reference I'm going to make during this show, because I don't want to get a headache. Anyway, throughout the match here, I don't want to go like move by move here, because it's quite the task here, but some great spots in here, and the crowd just seemed to be just really into things. And Misawa was focused on throughout a significant part of this match. And then Kobashi would come in, and the fans would be chanting for Kobashi. And really here, this was such a calling card for Kobashi that separated him from the others to me, was just his facials and selling, where he was just one of the great baby faces in Japanese history because of his facials.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, his facials, his body language. We'll kind of expand on this further. But, I mean, comparing him to some of these other guys, even Misawa and Kawada, Kobashi was always seemed to be more of a expressive performer, and one that was almost perfect in this role as, like, the rookie who is trying really hard to keep up with the rest.
Yeah, so the match really seems to go to another level following a top rope lariat, and it was involving Misawa here, who got the big tag, got this awesome reaction as he comes in with Tsuruta, and then hits that flying lariat off of the top. Taue comes in, hits this tope suicida to Misawa, and then Fuchi is in, hits this German suplex to Kobashi. I've got to say, even in 1990, Masafuchi looks like he's 65.
Yeah, I'd agree. How old was he at this time?
I think like 36, something really? Like that. I mean, looks anything but 36 at this point. Kobashi comes in, hit this bridging German for a two count on Fuchi. They're going through numerous near falls here at the end. Jumbo hit his big lariat to Kobashi, then blasts Misawa with a forearm, power bombs Kobashi for a two count, and a just giant pop from the audience. And then the finishing sequence features two running leg drops delivered to Jumbo, then a scoop slam. Fuchi blocks Kobashi from from hitting a moonsault, and Jumbo suplexes Kobashi off of the second rope for a two count, and then hits another follow-up high-angle suplex and pins Kobashi at 25 minutes and 47 seconds. So you had the initial just buzz for Misawa and Saruta, and then as the match continued to build, much more of a focus put on Kobashi throughout this match and his interaction with Saruta, and ultimately coming up short.
Absolutely. I found the story, you know, the storyline of the match to basically, as it relates to Kenta Kobashi, here he was in the ring with like this veteran Jumbo Saruta, who was basically having his way with Kobashi, and then in the end, Saruta, you know, despite being the more experienced veteran, had to do a lot more than he probably felt like he needed to finally put Kobashi away, because he was kicking out of everything. But yeah, I really enjoyed this match. Obviously, one of a a 5-star rated match. There's really nothing to really complain about. For a lot of people, though, if this was your first time watching an All Japan match, one of the other things you'll notice is that the concept of everybody kind of having their own signature strikes.
Yep.
In this case, this was actually even before Kobashi seemed to incorporate the chops into his moveset, because of course that's what he'd be known for. But you know, Misawa with the forearms, and then Kawada with the little kicks in the shin. I just always love that everybody kind of has their own equivalent to mirror somebody else.
Yeah, it's also fun to go back and watch some of these matches from this time period as well, and it's like you can see the direct influences that a lot of current guys have, specifically
absolutely.
In, you know, Ring of Honor, Dragon Gate USA, and such like that, and kind of see where they kind of drew a lot of influence from. So, I mean, this combination of, you know, these six were very predominant at this stage of things. And then as we moved more towards the 90s, it was just about 2 years later when Jumbo Saruta was diagnosed with hepatitis B. He would pass away in the year 2000. But pretty much from 1992 onwards, he was really reduced to kind of a mid-card performer, competing in a lot of trios matches, much like Giant Baba did, where they couldn't go at that point in time. So Misawa and Kobashi and Kawada, they really rose at this point and kind of became pretty much the top guys within the company. And Misawa was always kind of the top performer, and Kobashi was always kind of chasing Misawa. Kobashi would win his first Triple Crown title in 1996 from Akira Taue, but it was always the win over Misawa that eluded Kobashi and would actually never beat him in All Japan Pro Wrestling. This might have been their first meeting. This wouldn't have been. But this was...
As champion,
with Kobashi defending against Misawa January the 17th of 1997 in Osaka, Japan, for the Triple Crown title. And you mentioned, Wei, the tights that stood out so much with the green and the orange. A step above here, too, with the two greatest ring jackets ever. Like, I want to get matching jackets with you having an orange one and me a green one. These jackets were so great.
God, I would love one of these.
I would pay top dollar for one of these if it was like online somewhere, ahead of a Ribera steak jacket.
What color would you be?
I'd take either, man. I'd take green, maybe, if I had to pick.
No, you got to pick your own color.
My own color. I want to directly rip off this color scheme. But I don't know, maybe a blue?
You'd be blue? I could see that.
How about you?
I'd be beige.
Beige?
Yeah.
Why beige?
I don't know.
Like a khaki flavor.
No, I'd be like a flesh tone so that it looked like I was naked.
Well, that would...
Isn't that cool?
I'm sure that would endear you to many people. Naked man in the Tokyo Dome.
Yeah.
Waiting. I assume this is the first time you've seen this match, Wei?
No, I probably saw it before. I just I don't remember much from it. It's been such a long time, so might as well have been new.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's always... you know, when you go back to watch some of these matches, this match in particular for me, I had not seen before. And when you go back and someone tells you, you know, this is a 5-star match, or this is one of the best matches I've ever seen, to me, sometimes that's an even bigger handicap for a match to have when you're going into it with the expectation that this better be one of the best matches I've ever seen.
It's like that with anything. It's like that with movies. It's like that with music. Oh, you got to watch this. It's going to be the greatest thing ever. More often than not, I mean... I go in and I feel kind of disappointed because I'm expecting the greatest thing I've ever seen.
So this match starts off Misawa hitting this baseball slide that sends Kobashi to the floor and then hits his Tope Suicida. And that would kind of be, you know, familiar with these two, where they'd start off really, really big off the bat and then kind of settle things down when you got the sense that these guys are going really long as they were in this match.
Yeah, and it's a formula that we've seen emulated so often over the past decade in North America and still do today, especially in a lot of the indies. And it seemed to have worked, you know, like you get the crowd really hot, paying attention to start so that they care, and then slow it down for them before you progress
like
the pace again.
It's like Pat Patterson in Wrestling with Shadows laying out that match at Canadian Stampede with like Austin, and you hear Patterson say, "Well, you're going to start like House of Fire and then slow things down because you're going half hour." So that was, Pat Patterson's one of the greatest minds in wrestling. Yeah. I mean, that's start off hot, get the crowd, and then you simmer things down and then you bring it up again later.
Yeah.
So this match was just, as much as I say, of going in here with like huge expectations. I love this match. At the 10-minute mark, they have this chop forearm exchange, and then Misawa knocks Kobashi down and splashes him off the top for a two count. They exchange some big boots, chops, forearms, kicks, and then Misawa dives off the apron with Kobashi on the floor, but Kobashi moves away, and Misawa rams his arm into the steel barricade, and this would become the focus for the rest of the match, with Misawa selling his right arm and Kobashi just attacking it with stomps, ramming it into the barricade. This is where Kobashi felt like the subtle heel here. This guy going after the arm and, you know, using the barricade to try and continue to further injure the arm. I thought he just told this great story with Misawa essentially fighting with one arm.
Yeah, and really the other story just that, you know, I've never been able to pin this guy before. Here's my opportunity. Fuck being noble. I'm going to do anything I can to beat him.
Yeah, and it would lead to Kobashi working for some arm bars. He continues the attack. He hits another one of his trademark spots, the half Nelson suplex. And when he goes for the Fujiwara armbar, this crowd goes electric.
Yeah.
Like, there is a maneuver in the Japanese context that people are just educated to know the significance of.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's not even a move that was necessarily attributed to Kobashi, but I think it just says something about the believability of some of the previous work that when a move like that is enough to kind of let the audience think that there's a chance that this could end.
Misawa then, as he continues to sell here the arm and Kobashi is beating him down, he blocks one of Kobashi's lariats, and then Misawa kicks Kobashi's right arm, and then Kobashi starts clutching his right wrist, and they really call attention to it very well. And just Misawa trying to administer his offense, I mean, the struggle as he's trying to hit a double underhook suplex, and you just got the sense that he's just struggling here just to try and compete here with Kobashi with this one arm. It was really, I thought, really well done.
There was this really cool spot I found. I don't know if you're about to get to it or not, but like, there's one spot where like Kobashi goes for the lariat, but it's blocked by Misawa's elbow.
Yeah.
And then they both sell it like it hurt them both equally.
Yeah, and the crowd is just like at a fever pitch after this. It's just
and it's like I said. I mean, I just love the idea that everybody, you know, these two specifically, just had moves that were on par with each other. You know, like it's like in a video game. Okay, down B, you gotta select the move for that. That's the power move. Then you gotta select the finisher. Like everybody had something, whether it be a strike or a submission or a head dropping finisher that mirrored one another.
Yeah, and it's the point of a match where it's like you'll always hear about, you know, Japanese audiences, they're very reserved, but man, when there's that point, and sometimes it's just one sequence and suddenly the crowd is in that second gear, and that became apparent here in kind of the last like 10 to 15 minutes where they were just at another level, and you saw Kobashi go for a bridging powerbomb and getting a two count. He hit his orange crush, which was like a vertical suplex, and then dropping him like a powerbomb, which was another signature spot for him. He hit Misawa with another lariat, sending him to the outside of the apron, and then Kobashi tries to go for a powerbomb on the outside apron to the floor, and in midair, Misawa counters this with a hurricanrana. I jumped out of my seat and text messaged Wei as I saw this spot. This was, you know, the visual here. Eddie Guerrero and Rey Mysterio did this spot once. All respect to them, but you put like 100 pounds onto both of those guys, and that is what you saw here. This was ungodly impressive.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy. I mean, but you know, like when you think about it, like, okay, we just watched the Mick Foley DVD last week. Comparing, this was no fall from the Hell in a Cell, but I think in the context of, you know, what high spots were in Japanese matches, this was like really big. And that's all you need to do, really. Not to say that this was easy, but...
I will go so far as to say this is one of the most impressive spots I've seen in a pro wrestling match. That's how impressed I was by this. Just
apron moves were always a big thing in All Japan. Moves off the apron.
Yeah. They get back into the ring after this, after they're selling this on the floor, and Misawa hits a released German, a spinning lariat by Kobashi. Both men are down. Then there's a released German by Kobashi that puts Misawa on his neck. Then Misawa comes back with a spinning forearm to the back of Kobashi's neck, a tiger driver by Misawa for a near fall, and then the finish comes with Misawa hitting a full Nelson suplex, and then just a simple running forearm to knock Kobashi out and pins him 42 minutes and 6 seconds. I was just blown away by this match.
It was a lot of fun. It was really good. And you mentioned the Tiger Driver. This was actually the Tiger Driver 91.
That is right.
That's another thing. Like, I think part of the reason why I enjoyed these guys so much and I was so interested was because I was a big wrestling video game fan. And actually, you know, in the creative wrestlers in a lot of the new in the North American wrestling games, a lot of them, especially the Yuke's games, because they're created with a Japanese engine, they had the Japanese moves. And so, like, I would create a wrestler and I'd see all these, like, crazy head-dropping moves, and I'm like, I've never seen a WWF wrestler do this. Where did this come from? And I would soon learn that, okay, it was a move like this, the Tiger Driver 91, or the Burning Hammer, that, like, moves that, you know, this was during the head-dropping era of All Japan Pro Wrestling, when I don't know how you even train for stuff like this, but like it got to the point where they eventually had to kind of outdo one another for how many drops to the head that they could do. And
and there would be the argument that the bar was just set too high, that it was impossible,
and it would kill basically all your other finishes, right? You can no longer just do a standard Tiger Driver for believability anymore.
I mean, as much as, you know, that the 90s period, specifically in All Japan, is just romanticized. I mean, it was some of the greatest wrestling you've ever seen. But mm-hmm. at the same time, I mean, you look at where some of these guys are today. I mean, these guys wrecked their bodies, mm-hmm. and some not even around anymore. I mean, it was an unbelievable price that some of these guys paid working this style.
But nonetheless, it definitely hooked a kid like me, you know, oh, wow, look at this. He's dropped him on his head. And I just love the idea that there are finishers that are super finishers. You know what I mean?
The Gonzo Bomb.
Yeah, something like that. Exactly, something like that. I mean, maybe normally Misawa would just finish a match with a run elbow or the regular Tiger Driver, but only on special occasions does he pull out his extra special move.
I always was a big fan of when they would do kind of a different finish where it wasn't the finisher, and it was, you know, like Owen Hart pinning Bret Hart with just a victory roll block.
Sure.
And just a finish out of nowhere, where it kind of educates the audience that it doesn't mean finisher is the ultimate destination for a match, that you can't get into other spots. It was always very smart, and that's why I really enjoyed this finish, just a simple running forearm after all of this, and it's the running forearm that knocks Kobashi out at the end. So, a fantastic match. They would follow up this match with 5-star matches. There was one in October of 1998, one in June of 1999, and it was always Misawa coming out on top, and that would always be this overarching story of Kobashi's career of chasing Misawa and trying to get that elusive victory, and that would kind of come to fruition not until they formed Pro Wrestling Noah, mm-hmm. and that was the big storyline, was Misawa Kobashi. But I guess we can discuss that a bit, because the dissension came in 2000. Giant Baba had passed away in 1999, and his wife Motoko Baba had taken over the company.
Makoto, I think.
It was Motoko.
Motoko?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe that's how it's pronounced. She had taken over the company and kind of was at odds with Misawa, who in the spring of 2000 went to the NTV network, which was broadcasting All Japan at the time, was able to get the television contract to start a new company, and pretty much took the what was left of All Japan, minus a couple of notable performers. I know Dr. Death Steve Williams stayed with All Japan. Toshiaki Kawada did. But essentially everyone else, Kobashi, Misawa, Akiyama, everybody went to this new promotion of Pro Wrestling Noah. And Kobashi was in terrible health at this time. He was used in some of the earlier matches within Noah, where the prime focus was Jun Akiyama, and elevating this guy to be the focal point of this new company with Misawa and Kobashi put in the role to make this guy. He never really clicked at that top level that a Kobashi or a Misawa were, but they tried very hard with him. And as Kobashi, his knees were just wrecked from all those moonsaults he had taken, pretty much missed all of, he missed all of 2001, where he had just all these knee surgeries. I think it was a total of like something like 14 knee surgeries within the year. Came back in February of 2002, where it was a big sellout at Budokan Hall for Kobashi's return. And it was just a tag match where he was teaming with Misawa against Akiyama and Yuji Nagata, re-injures his knee in that match, then sits out the rest of 2002, and that, or about 6 months, comes back, and it had all built up to the creation of the GHC title in March of 2003, where Kobashi finally got his win over Misawa in an incredible match, and Kobashi won the GHC title and started a two-year run as champion, which solidified Noah to me as the top wrestling company in Japan at the time.
Yeah, the ascension of the company really follows the, I mean, shows the strength of a belt and the strength of a championship.
And it was through this run with Kobashi as the champion where Noah, after a year of Kobashi as champion, felt that they were in a position where they could run the Tokyo Dome, which was a giant step up, going from Budokan Hall, which holds 16,000 and change, to 60,000 seat Tokyo Dome. And were you aware, Wei, the original plan was to do Kenta Kobashi and Bob Sapp in the main event of this show.
I didn't know that. Wow.
This was at the height. Bob Sapp's, I guess his popularity peak was still very much, you know, they were at the tail end of it in 2004, but still a massive name who I guess they were simply looking at, we got to fill this dome, and Bob Sapp is that big name. But imagine in hindsight seeing that match.
Oh, yeah, probably wouldn't have been the same.
Do you think we would have been reviewing that today?
Probably not.
Maybe out of morbid curiosity.
Yeah, I would watch it though.
But that fell through. And they had to settle for Jun Akiyama and a 5-star match. They did a live gate of $2.5 million for this show. And, Wei, why don't you kind of talk a little bit about this match? Because this was featured on the Fight Network, and you produced those shows. And had you seen this match before we acquired Noah at all?
No, I hadn't. I hadn't really watched any Noah at the time. I was just familiar with some of their All Japan work. But, I mean, I started working for the Fight Network, and then at some point they just asked me, because they knew I was a wrestling fan, as well as an editor, hey, do you want to kind of oversee some of this stuff and prepare these matches and take some notes down for English commentary that we were about to do. And so Dan the Mouth of Ransky, of course, we hired because he is a very fantastic pro wrestling historian. And as well, we were looking for a commentator, English commentator for these matches. But I mean, I don't even know how we ultimately arrived at Moro, because I guess I had always assumed he was just an MMA guy. I didn't really know he had done any pro wrestling.
I'm trying to remember exactly how it was, and I believe it was like we were looking for somebody to come in and be a host for the network. And I think it was the original idea for just for Noah were looking for someone for. And originally, I remember we were thinking of using Gail Kim actually to do commentary for Noah. And
with Dan?
I don't know if she was going to be paired with Dan. She might have been. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to necessarily take credit, but I'm pretty sure I was the one that suggested Moro.
Yeah, I think you were too.
Because I had seen his stuff for Stampede Wrestling, and really just read a lot about Moro through the Observer, because Meltzer was a big fan of Moro's, and that, you know, this guy's doing this excellent work, and it's just kind of just in Calgary. And he had obviously been doing Pride at this point as well. He's, you know, not local, but at least in
Canadian.
Canada, and someone that could, I mean, it's a very small list. Yep. I think we even tried, I mean, I think Mike Tenay's name was thrown out as well, and I don't know if he was allowed to do it because of TNA, but I mean, it was a short list of people because there weren't really a ton of people that, I mean, it's a very difficult style of wrestling to call. I mean, pro wrestling commentary in and of itself is a pretty small fraternity.
Absolutely. But, you know, once Moro did come in and we got into that studio and sat him down with Dan, I mean, I just knew that we were in good hands the moment Moro showed up with his printed out big book of wrestling moves.
Oh, this was awesome.
Do you know about the, there's this, there used to be a website, I don't know if it's still around, but it was called the Big Book of Wrestling Moves, BBOWM. And, it's basically just a long glossary in plain text of, every wrestling move you could imagine. I don't know. I don't even know. It's completely updated at the moment. But like, basically every move you can think of. A lot of Japanese wrestling moves. And this here it is. John's pulled it up right now.
It's in three parts.
It looks like a website from 1996.
Okay, let's just here. Let's Orange Crush. Oh no, that'll be later. Here's one example. Bulldog, twisting three-quarter face lock, used by Spike Dudley. A.K.A. Acid Drop. Description. The attacker applies three-quarter face lock, basically the victim's head on the attacker's shoulder with the attacker forming a headlock around the top of their head as the attacker has their back to the victim and runs towards a corner and runs up the ring ropes with the face lock still applied. The attacker kicks off the top rope and shifts their body weight, swinging their body around. As the attacker falls to the ground, the victim's chin is driven into the attacker's shoulder. First of all, the idea that they are identified as attacker and victim, yeah. Awesome.
Oh, of course. How else would you describe it?
The victim.
But I mean, you know, for somebody like
this is incredible. I've actually never seen this.
A nerd for pro wrestling terminology, correct pro wrestling terminology, knowing what inverted is versus reverse. Like, I knew we were in good hands the moment Moro showed up with a printed version of this.
Oh my god! Super, this is how many pages would this have been? Holy
super
fuck!
Thick binder, and you know, so you know, needless to say, hopefully some of you have watched the match. If not, please go check it out because it is definitely worth your while to see a world.
Part one is 334 pages just alone.
Jesus,
with size 13 font.
But it really is worth your while just to see, you know, in my opinion, world class talent, both in commentary and in the wrestling ring, you know, working together in a match.
Yeah, so I'm glad you've posted that because a lot of people have probably never seen that, and it's you know, a fantastically called match. And it took place July the 10th, 2004. And Kobashi and Akiyama were always linked throughout their careers. Akiyama's debut match was against Kobashi in September of 1992, and this would be their first singles match in 4 years. They hadn't they had a match December the 23rd of 2000, so you had a long stretch here between matches for singles matches.
They're also well-known tag team partners as part of Burning.
Yes. The match started off with a test of strength early and the pacing around the ring by Akiyama. They would have their chop forearm exchanges throughout the match. And interesting here, Kobashi would use the running knee to the gut, which was something Jumbo Tsuruta would use quite a lot. And
you mean Akiyama?
Right. Kobashi did this too in this match,
okay.
I noticed. I missed Akiyama doing it. Anyway, the match, it kind of picks up with a DDT on the apron to Kobashi, running him into the barricade, and definitely different way when you're in a stadium show and kind of, I mean, you know, working for an audience of, you know, 50,000 as opposed to a more intimate venue where it's just a couple thousand people. So it was interesting to see how they work this match in a different venue.
Yeah, absolutely. A very different stage. If you watch some of the other Noah shows, I mean, they took place in places like Kurokun Hall, where you know, not even a quarter of the size of this.
Yeah, that's only a couple thousand. Akiyama applied a guillotine choke that really picked up the crowd here. I mean, they were really. It just shows the education level for submissions. And this, let's remember the time period here of 2004 when mm-hmm. Pride was at its peak, and you know Noah was a company that obviously reacted to what was working within combat sports at that time and incorporating it.
Well, it's just those two sports are just so linked together. I mean, you had guys like Minoru Suzuki and Yoshihiro Takayama who were actually current members of the Noah roster at this time. So there certainly was a lot of education there.
We saw the spot that Kobashi does, the rabid chops in the corner, then the spinning chops to the neck. And one of the key elements to those chops, Wei, was just how the victim sold them. I mean, it was just those spinning chops to the neck, it was like death.
Yeah, I don't think there needed much I don't know, acting skill to sell one of those. They just, that's the thing about like some of these like strikes. They don't look like they were necessarily worked at all. Like it just felt like, hit me as hard as you can with the blade of your hand, and then I'll just react to it.
Kobashi would follow through a half Nelson suplex, the Orange Crush. Akiyama then blocks the Burning Hammer and hits a German suplex to Kobashi. Then Akiyama is on the outside of the apron. Both men are teasing suplexes, and it ends with Akiyama hitting the Exploder suplex off of the second rope to the floor, which was the big spot of the match.
Yeah.
This was unbelievable.
It was pretty nuts. It was pretty nuts. And I just, have to talk about the commentary again, because I thought Moro and Dan just did a great job of always following the pace of the action. I'd always watched wrestling, but I didn't really understand, kind of the nuances of pro wrestling commentary until I started, helping out with some of these shows. And just to see the two of them be able to kind of follow, switch gears, basically. Basically follow the pace of a match, just like in a good wrestling match, you might start off at a zero and then build up to a one and then to a two and a three. The commentary certainly reflected that, and I found like Moro's just ability to kind of layer himself and flow with the match to be just very good, very astounding. And Dan, of course, with his knowledge of the product and bring a lot of the history and the storylines into it, was just we couldn't have found a better team.
Akiyama then hit a super exploder off the top into the ring for a two count on Kobashi, and it just the match was kind of just in another level at this point. Akiyama using headbutts to get another guillotine choke. He gets out. Kobashi gets out. Akiyama with another exploder that Kobashi kicks out of. Then Kobashi hits a brainbuster, which just looked insane. Mm-hmm. This brainbuster that Akiyama took, and then a half Nelson. Akiyama pops up. Akiyama hits an exploder. Kobashi pops up, hits a half Nelson, then another exploder. Both pop up, just completely no selling these moves, but the crowd is just can't believe what they're watching here, as both men are just rising from these finishes.
These like no sell sequences that we still see a lot, especially like on like indie shows and whatnot. It's like a concept that really just goes against so much of what pro wrestling is. Okay, I'm going to give you my big finisher, but you're going to pretend like it doesn't hurt. Then we're going to do a bunch of moves to each other, and we're just going to get pop right back up. It's a concept that, like, I'm sure when it first debuted was, like, I don't know, pretty incredible, just because you don't think it would work, but, like, it has worked, and it works so well.
That's always been my thinking when it comes to this. Like, there are people who are going to watch this and be like, oh, these guys, they have no psychology at all. To me, having
this is like the pinnacle of psychology.
I would be with you, because if a crowd sits on their hands, then that's right. You don't have psychology. It's not working. You are working for that audience and what they want. And this crowd was on their feet here during this finish and building up to this finish.
It is almost the equivalent of like hulking up, like Hulk Hogan hulking up, but in shorter bursts. And I mean, imagine what the Hulk Hogan character would be, and imagine what pro wrestling would be without that hulking up gimmick.
The finish came after Kobashi hits a moonsault for a two count, and then the Burning Hammer to get the win Akiyama.
His super move that he only pulls out very rarely.
Yes. So the moonsault, which was probably a move he should have retired 10 years before this very match, but would continue to break it out, killed his knees. But nonetheless, getting the win here, it was a huge match at the time. Some people anticipated Akiyama winning the title here, but Kobashi would keep that title until March of the following year, where he would drop it to Takeshi Rikyo. And it really was a case that it was impossible to follow this guy's title run,
no matter who
you put it on.
I mean, you think of like great title runs of the past 10 years. You think of this, and then, of course, you think of Samoa Joe holding the ROH title for 2 years. In both cases, really helping build the promotion that they held the titles for. In Joe's case, basically putting a lot of value behind that ROH championship and the promotion itself to make that title seem like something everybody wants. And in this case, Kobashi just having a number of great matches in this 2 year span.
Yeah, it was, Kobashi was the key to Noah's success during this time period, being able to sell out Budokan Hall. And just Kobashi, I mean, it was just one of the most legendary title runs, I would say, of the past 25 years. I mean, it was was just so significant for Pro Wrestling Noah at that time, and they certainly felt it after he lost that title. And then he was diagnosed with cancer in 2006, had a a kidney removed as a result of that cancer, would make a comeback in December of 2007, but it was clear that Kobashi, he had to be used in a reduced role. He just couldn't do this kind of match anymore.
Yeah, unfortunately. But going back to this era, he went on to be named Wrestler of the Year by the Observer in both 03 and 04 as a result of this string of matches during this title run.
So wait, to wrap up the Tokyo Dome at this time, we'll go on over to our interview with Mauro Ranallo, who, as you mentioned, called this match for the Fight Network along with Dan the Mouth Lavransky, and we got some of his thoughts on both calling this match and his own memories of Kenta Kobashi. Joining us now on the line all the way from California, our good pal, our former Fight Network colleague. He is the man whose voice you heard calling that great Kenta Kobashi Jun Akiyama match from the Tokyo Dome show in 2004. Mauro Ranallo, are you there, my man?
I'm here, you guys, and it's so wonderful to be reunited with two of my favorite colleagues of my broadcast career, and what a... What memories, and thanks, by the way, Wei, and you too, John, for putting that up on YouTube. I've gotten so much feedback over the last few days from people who were shocked, first of all, to hear me calling a pro wrestling match. I guess some people still don't, believe that I was involved in pro wrestling for a large part of my life, and still, as we all know, follow it closely. But it was actually my Noah commentary that proved to be kind of an audition for my gig at the Fight Network. So it really is cool to be reminiscing about one of the greatest in-ring performers who recently hung up his boots.
And I was so impressed, Mauro, not just by your call of the match, but, getting to work with you that day. You were very under the weather that morning, and then you come in and you call a match that Dave Meltzer describes as the best called match of the entire year. I mean, it was an incredible performance. And I think people, I was glad Wei uploaded this because a lot of people who may have missed it on the Fight Network now getting to see this this legendary match with your call attached to it.
Well, Dave was very gracious in putting over Dan the Mouth Lavransky in my call, and I had a blast working with the Mouth, and of course Wei instrumental in don't take anything away from Wei Ting and how he helped me with his preparation, the organized notes, and just the fact that I was getting a chance to call some of the best wrestling in the world with Pro Wrestling Noah at the time. And you're right, it was the night before, I guess, had been kind of the let's get to know each other party, and Mr. Kevin Kelly had taken me to a local establishment, and needless to say, the Heineken was flowing freely. But I came in that morning with Dan, and again, how can you butcher a Kenta Kobashi Jun Akiyama match? You'd have to be, like Herb Abrams awful to do that kind of thing.
Now, when you were preparing for this, Mauro, particularly this match, which was such a classic, did you watch this match ahead of time? Were you watching this cold? How did you prepare for this? Because this is very different from when you're calling like a live boxing or mixed martial arts bout, obviously.
Great question, and this goes back to my time spent in Calgary with Stampede Wrestling between 1999 and 2000 when I first got to do play-by-play. I started my career in pro wrestling, as most people know, as a bad guy manager in All-Star Wrestling from 86 to 89, did a little bit of color commentary as well, but as a play-by-play announcer for pro wrestling, I cut my teeth with the resurrection of Stampede Wrestling, where guys like, Harry Smith now, Davey Boy Smith Jr., and Tyson Kidd, and Teddy Hart, and Jack Evans, and all of them, Natty, and Natalya, everyone was around at the time, and I told Bruce Hart, who hired me, and I said to them, I don't want to know the finishes. I really wanted to treat it like I was watching it for the first time. And when we did the tape of the Noahs, same thing. Wei put all this wonderful tape together and says, okay, you can see this, you can see that. And I did watch some of the matches, but this one in particular, because of the magnitude, I really wanted to be as surprised genuinely like I was watching it for the first time. So that's what I did. I did not see it prior, and I wanted to just react as I was watching it for the first time. And I really do believe that those who enjoyed it, and again, thank you to Dave Meltzer and everyone who did send me positive feedback. I think that's one of the reasons it was so effective for me anyway, was the fact that I was watching it for the first time as it unfolded on the tape.
I just remember those sessions, and just I mean, we ended up doing something like 40 episodes of all these pro wrestling Noahs, and I just remember every single time people would walk into the other side of the room where I was doing the audio and just the other side of the glass, and like so often people would just like marvel at what was happening and the energy that was taking place in that recording studio between you and Dan, and I always thought you did a great job of just creating that atmosphere.
Well, and something I've always had, and it's been the polarizing thing about me, Wayne, and I appreciate that, my man, is the fact that a lot of people wonder, okay, is that manufactured energy? No one can be that energetic or that up or that passionate for as long as this guy is without, you know, maybe he's just faking it for the microphone or the camera. And as you guys who are not just colleagues but friends who have spent social time with me and even already on the phone call, I listen to the way you guys pose the question and listen to the way I answer, and it's now, what is it here? It's early morning out on the West Coast. This is who I am, and whether it's something people appreciate or not, and I know it's not for everyone, as I keep saying, it cannot change because it's me. I will not change for anyone. It's gotten me to where I am, and especially with professional wrestling and that style, the Puro Wrestler style, where it was more authentic, more legitimate. I didn't want to, you know, come in and treat it like a joke or make wisecracks about something that was presented as serious athletic entertainment. And for me, marveling is the word I was using to describe what I was calling. It's not hyperbole, even though hyperbole is the greatest word ever. And I've been accused of that in the past, and maybe at times rightfully so. But this was one of the all-time great matches under the roof of the Tokyo Dome, the Noah's first event there, knowing the storyline and the history between Akiyama and Kobashi and the way they told their story. And I think I used the soundbite, in fact, guys, as you know, on my new show now on my website where I used that soundbite that came to me at that moment, recollecting, because in my mind I'm like, what can I compare this to? And sure enough, Owen Hart versus Bret Hart at WrestleMania 10, Ricky Steamboat, Randy Savage, WrestleMania 3, Ric Flair and Ricky Steamboat and their legendary battles in Chicago and New Orleans. And yet, to me, this was the pinnacle. These are two guys that are stiff, that are telling a story, but are putting it all on the line in the crescendo, the ebb and flow, and yet, in many ways, as I told Samoa Joe on the interview that I did with him recently, coming off his 5-star match with Kobashi in Ring of Honor, it was brilliant in its simplicity. And I always say that about the Beatles or about some of the most amazing things or inventions in life are things that a 3-year-old or an 80-year-old can appreciate. And that's what pro wrestling has always been about to me when it's more effective. And that's what Kobashi and Akiyama represents to me. It was just amazing in what they were able to do that day in Tokyo.
How would you say that your experience in pro wrestling has influenced in your MMA and your boxing play-by-play?
Oh, I think there's a big influence in the sense that I am genuinely hyped. I get the marketing, and I think that's what the UFC, and maybe one of the reasons why even, okay, maybe go off on a quick tangent here. The first time I met Frank Shamrock was when we did the Elite XC show, the first ever Elite XC event, when he fought Hensel Gracie in South Haven, Mississippi. He comes into the interview room, and of course I'm with Jay Glazer and Bill Goldberg, and we're doing the interview and everything else, and for whatever reason, after the interview, he comes up to me and he goes, Morrow, you know. And I went, what do you mean? What do I know? He goes, just you know. And what he meant, I found out later, was the fact that I get the stories. I get the above and beyond, you know, just simply calling moves. You have to emotionally get invested. You have to sell, and the word sell is the operative word here, these people, these characters, these stories. And MMA and boxing, the reason some guys become champions or make all the money and others are very talented but never see the past the curtain jerking moments is because they don't know how to sell themselves. And as an announcer, yes, I know some people just want us to be, just detailing the events of what we see, but I have to embellish it. I have to make people care. The girlfriend or the wife that's sitting on the couch supporting her man who may not be a boxing fan but realizes that, a guy like Danny Garcia defeated cancer overcame, you know, cancer to become a back to the ring and become a prospect. And so those kinds of moments, for me, as an MMA and boxing commentator, that's what I take about pro wrestling, away from pro wrestling, was the storytelling. Pro wrestling is all about storytelling, and the legends like Jim Ross, who was a huge MMA aficionado, and others, that's what they, I think, like most about me. And one of the positive things from my pro wrestling background is that I do think I'm pretty good at telling a story and adding the emotion and drama when necessary. Now, some feel that maybe I'm like that all the time, and if that's the case, I apologize. I'm always working at getting better. I know there has to be peaks and valleys, and I can't start in fifth gear during the ring introduction. You got to build it up, and I've been very fortunate to work with many talented people that have helped hone my skills along the way. But to make the answer even longer way, I think that's the biggest thing I took away from my pro wrestling experience was storytelling.
As you kind of look back, as kind of all wrestling fans are right now, in the wake of Kenta Kobashi's retirement, how are you going to remember this performer? Because obviously there's just the body of work that for many is second to none. On the other side as well, Moro, I mean, you do look at the physical toll this guy put his body through. And by extension, I mean, in the unfortunate circumstances, his most famous partner in Mitsuharu Musawa as well, who is no longer with us because in large part to this style. It seems that there's definitely two extremes here to look at in terms of what these men put their bodies through for everyone else's enjoyment.
And that's the key right there. How can you not respect? You can maybe say, wow, what an idiot at the end, or that's crazy, but he was so committed to his craft and the art that is professional wrestling. And you can talk to the all greats, and how many times do we have to try to explain ourselves? Because let's face it, as we know, even in the modern era, in all eras of professional wrestling, there's been schlock, there's been goofiness, and some of it is inexcusable and indefensible. But with what they did in Japan and the Puro Resu and the rise of the Misawas and the Kobashis and so many amazing workers and so many North American stars, the Harts and the British Bulldogs and Stan Hansen and all of these names that went to Japan and come back with mutton. You know, even the late Chris Benoit, who I know is supposed to be a persona non grata, and yes, what he did was horrible, but a fantastic worker inside the ring. Kobashi was able to let us truly believe, because a lot of what he was doing was real. He was able to blur the lines of professional wrestling and what a lot of people now know as sports entertainment. Did he pay a toll? Yes, but ask any great athlete. Ask anyone who has achieved the greatest heights of success. There is always sacrifice involved, whether it is mentally, whether it is physically, whether it is with relationships. There is a price to be paid. And yes, some pay a greater price, but I would say that Kenta Kobashi would have little regrets about what he was able to give his audience, and for him to be able to do it night in and night out and come back and even in his retirement match pull off another moonsault, and known for his trademark chops, and you know, even talking to Samoa Joe on my show and anyone who's taken those chops, there's nothing fake about that. So for me, Kenta Kobashi has to be, he's almost in a category all of his own, or maybe I almost look at it, you know, there's the hybrids, there's the Luthes, the Ric Flairs, the Ricky Steamboats, I mean, the Briscoes, the Bruno Sammartino, you know, there's so many fantastic workers, and yet he was a shoot worker, if there were a thing, and his facial expressions, and watching Samoa Joe's match again with him, the simple little things, but what a lot of workers even today forget, they're trying to memorize all those high spots that they have to get through, and then the fact they're only given 2 minutes to do it takes away even more. He was an amazing, effective storyteller just with his face, and that's saying something.
Yeah, that was such a key to him. And for those of you that have not seen the match, it is posted online. You can go to youtube.com/way0937 and you can watch this match. Jun Akiyama, Kenta Kobashi, called by Moro Ranallo and Dan Lavransky. And before we get out of here, Moro, you mentioned the Samoa Joe interview from last week. It's a fascinating chat about his 2005 bout with Kenta Kobashi. And tell our listeners a bit more about the show. And by the time this is up, they'll be able to check out episode 7 this week.
Yeah, well, one thing, and you know what, this week, as you know, you're my walking encyclopedia of dates there, Prodigy Pollock. We're marking the anniversary. When was it that we started? Has it been 6 years now?
It was May 2006, so
it's 7 years.
Oh, no, you're right, 2007. I messed up on the 6 years.
No worries. So 6 years that we started Fight Network Radio, which to this day was my favorite, you know, iteration or permutation or whatever you want to call the version of all the shows I've been involved with over the years as a radio or podcast. And a lot of it had to do with you, John. The fact that I knew it, you know, right when I met you and had heard of you, of course, with The Law and Live, you guys were of similar mind. And that's what I liked about the nucleus at the Fight Network, is that we were all pro wrestling fans, MMA fans, boxing fans, and we all cared about each sport and wanted to bring it to light. So for me, when I started Fight Network Radio, and at first there was a bit of a pushback going, well, wait a minute, you are going to alienate, you know, boxing fans who can't stand wrestling, or MMA was trying to separate itself from pro wrestling, and that may have been the case, but I was so blessed, and I'm even more blessed now, to have had the opportunity to be involved at the highest levels of each respective form of sport and entertainment that is pro wrestling, MMA, and boxing. So when I made the move to California, I wanted to go back to those roots because I feel that there was almost a bit of a void in that, you know, I could bring together maybe some of these fans that wanted to like wrestling again, or at least remember the old days, who are now left it for MMA, and I've heard that via Twitter and other forms of social media. But in keeping it pro wrestling related now for the sake of this topic, I mean, right off the gate, I'm the one guy I've always wanted to interview, someone that I consider a mentor in many ways, and people always ask, who do you influence yourself? Well, I try to be an original as much as we can, because we all are. But Jim Ross, next to Gordon Solie, you know, Lance Russell, there was Jim Ross, and he, to me, represents all that I like about professional wrestling commentators and the art of storytelling, the passion, the knowledge, how to get over an angle, how to get over an athlete. So Jim Ross was my first guest pro wrestling related. I've had the opportunity and pleasure to talk to Harry Smith and reminisce about the great Stampede Wrestling and his legendary father, Davey Boy. I've had Christopher Daniels, who remains one of my favorite performers right now with Frankie Kazarian, maybe the most entertaining act is Bad Influence in pro wrestling right now. And then Sean Waltman, who has been through everything and coming off that, you know, heinous injury in Jerry Lynn's retirement match. And now maybe my most high profile and the guy that I was very surprised that I'd even get the chance to talk to. But thanks to Sean Waltman, X-Pac, I'm bringing you an over 1 hour epic interview with the one and only the bad guy, you guys. Scott Hall will join me on the show number 7, wow, discussing his recent hip surgery and how Diamond Dallas Page has really, in an essence, saved his life. We talk about his days as Razor Ramon. We talk about the MSG incident, the click, the formation of the end. I mean, it is truly amazing. And I got to say, and I'm not just doing this to sell the interview, it is so rewarding to be able to talk to someone who I even told him I thought we'd lose him. Let's face it, there was a Deadpool where Scott Hall was probably number one on the list. And to hear where he is at now, and to hear it in his voice, the clarity. He's been sober for, I think, close to over a month and a half anyway. And he talking about it as a daily struggle. It's definitely an interview I'd go out of my way to listen to, and he has just been blown away by the support he received via social media to raise the money for his surgery. But, you know, this here's a guy who is on the road to redemption, and to hear him in his own words is quite something. So I hope your listeners will give it a shot. It's the show number 7 on Moro Ranallo /the show. And, oh, there are a couple of other guys that are going to be on this week. You know, TJ Grant, who's perfect 4-0 in the UFC and fighting Gray Maynard at UFC 160 for a shot at the lightweight title. And then someone you guys might have heard of, former heavyweight boxing champion. Wait a minute, his name escapes me. Let me check it. Oh, yeah, George Foreman is going to be on the show this week.
Oh, the guy with the grill. I think I've heard of him. Well, there you go.
Anyway, guys, living the dream in Southern California, but missing you guys greatly, and I do appreciate always being a part of the our own clique at the Fight Network. And tell Ramdeen I'm going to kick his ass if he doesn't come on my show soon.
Well, we're going to make sure that happens. Once again, go over to MoroRinaldo.com/the show. It truly is the Combat Sports 360. Everything is covered, which is what I personally really love about the show. Some great in-depth interviews, and Moro, you're doing a great job there. You can get it as well on iTunes and Stitcher. And he is the voice of Showtime Boxing and Invicta FC, who are coming back with a show in July. So lots of stuff coming up. One of the busiest men in combat sports. So thanks a lot, Moro, for taking some time to reminisce with us here on our little show.
Combat Sports 360, you bastard, you did it again.
I just give you all this. You've gone from Wolf Blitzer to Anderson Cooper here in terms of your gimmicks.
The Situation Room has moved, baby, but needless to say, Feeling very happy these days, guys. And Way, next time don't talk so much.
Feel free to steal the 360, Moro. It's all yours.
Awesome stuff, guys. That was fantastic, and I hope pass across soon. I'm really happy with what you guys are doing, and very proud of you guys. So keep up
thanks,
the great
Moro.
Work.
Thanks. There you go. Nothing like surprising Moro Ranallo with an impromptu phone call to chat about Kenta Kobashi at 10 a.m. his time in California.
Well, he's always ready.
He's always ready to go. That's hey Moro, you got a few minutes here? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So that was cool to have Moro on. And that takes us way past the Tokyo Dome, where they would return in 2005. And that was the same year that Kobashi would lose the GHC title to Takeshi Rikio. And in 2006, it became known that he was diagnosed with cancer. He had one of his kidneys removed and then would make his comeback in late December of 2007. And it was really at this point where Kobashi just could not go at that same level. He was put into a lot of trios matches. He would have a lot of downtime and really kind of altered his style. We saw many more chops worked into his matches, which incidentally led to a ton of elbow problems because of his chops. And that's something Kojima does quite a lot now, the big chop spot in the corner. But this was kind of, I mean, the writing was certainly on the wall for Kobashi winding things down at this point, but was still someone that the audience wanted to see.
Yeah, and how was the what about the business aspect of Noah at the time?
I mean, they've certainly suffered over the last couple of years. I mean, they're definitely a struggling promotion at this point, and you got to also compare it to the fact that they lost their TV deal in 2009, just a few months before Misawa died, which was, you know, a huge blow to the company. Kobashi is just, he's not someone you can put in that main event position anymore, and they're trying to create new stars, but it's very hard to do when you have a cold company, and that's certainly what they have right now. I mean, their booking has certainly been brought into question, and this whole handling of the retirement has somewhat been a black eye as well, because they just couldn't afford Kobashi's contract. It led to the whole burning stable leaving Noah, but kind of saving face by saying that Kobashi will have a retirement match, will do it with Noah, but after this retirement match, I don't think you're going to see Kobashi ever associated with Noah again. He is going to be a fixture with All Japan Pro Wrestling as the PWF commissioner. Mm-hmm. So it hasn't been, I think, the best handling of this retirement whole situation and how it came out the way it did.
Let's just talk a little about that. So the news came out in December that Noah had decided to let go of Kenta Kobashi from his contract.
Yeah, word got leaked that his contract was not going to be renewed.
How active was Kenta Kobashi prior to him this announcement?
I mean, it was very much, it wasn't like he was working a regular schedule at this point. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was pretty well being phased out, but it's in particular in Japanese wrestling, it's been, you know, for these guys that ultimately, you know, go to these lengths to get this promotion over, and for a lot of them kind of, you know, mortgage their own body as a result of it, it's kind of understood that they have a job for life, and that's why you see a lot of performers that remain there for as long as they want. It's really a respect deal, and I mean, no one has kind of represents that more than Kenta Kobashi, as someone that you would figure this promotion would be loyal to. And that's why the other burning representatives were just so outraged at this, led, of course, by Jun Akiyama, and just feeling this was a massive sign of disrespect to Kobashi.
Yeah, and so who are the people that ultimately decided not to re-sign with Noah and go to All Japan out of respect to Kenta Kobashi?
Well, we had, of course, Goshi Osaki, Yoshinobu Kanemaru, Jun Akiyama. Yep. I mean, those were
Tsushi Aoki
and Aoki as well.
Right.
And it's led to a lot of interest for All Japan Pro Wrestling, just getting this influx of new talent, new matches to create out of it. And All Japan's, you know, got its own struggles as well. It's like New Japan is the clear number one office right now, but it's put Noah really as a distant, really number four. I would position them below Dragon Gate.
Oh wow, and you know, maybe even at this point, people very suspicious about whether or not they would even last too much longer.
Yeah.
Right.
It's so it was essentially here to kind of, this whole retirement situation was booking Budokan Hall for one last show and really working on a lot of nostalgia here when you consider who is involved here. And the fact that Kenta Kobashi just headlining one more Budokan Hall show was a draw in and of itself, and probably the last time we're going to see a wrestling card at Budokan Hall for the foreseeable future, because no company is going to be able to run that venue and have any success. There's just not, New Japan doesn't run it, and the other companies, they just don't have the kind of talent to draw there. The retirement match took place earlier this month, featuring Kobashi teaming with Keiji Muto, Kensuke Sasaki, and Jun Akiyama to take on Kenta, Maybach Taniguchi, Yoshinobu Kanemaru, and Go Shiosaki. So
pretty much all of the talent in this match, wrestling in this Noah main event, are All Japan talent, except, of course, Kenta, who is the GHC champion at the time, and Maybach and Kensuke Sasaki.
Yeah, and, I mean, obviously, the Kobashi's team, I mean, lots of connections here on this side. Of course, Akiyama and Sasaki, who he had his two Tokyo Dome matches within Noah. Keiji Muto, who, that was always kind of a singles program that kind of had eluded both men's careers. They had faced off in tag situations, but teaming up here, just kind of symbolic of two guys of a generation that's really kind of coming to a close right now, with both men at the end of their careers at this point, and then taking on guys that really had that association with Kenta Kobashi. And the match went about 40 minutes away, and I was just blown away by how much Kobashi was a part of this match, and kind of, I'm sure, knowing that, you know, this was it and he was going to do as much as his body could. And certainly that's a fraction of what his pedigree showcases, but nonetheless, this was quite a performance to go out on.
It was, and certainly to watch it right after some of his greatest performances, like I did, you know, watching some of his matches in his prime, and even the Akiyama match, which was, to me, like, it's just as good as any of his other matches in All Japan. You definitely can't compare. This is certainly not even.
This was all about nostalgia and leaving people with a good feeling at the end of it, rather than putting on a match of the year.
I would say this wasn't even like 75% of what Kenta Kobashi was. This was certainly a more beat down, broken up Kenta Kobashi, who was noticeably much slower in his reactions. Like, it got to the point where at some points you really felt like the talent was moving into position for him. The chops were a little slower. They weren't happening as fast. But to me,
they certainly were, though, in quantity.
Yes, they were. Like, to me, though, the appeal of this match was that we were going to see a man who had just battled, you know, successfully battled cancer, battled multiple knee and elbow operations, trying to live up to his former legacy one last time, and just the guts that he displayed in trying to do that made this match very emotional.
And you had a crowd that, I mean, they wanted to just love this match. The Budokan Hall show, it sold out a month in advance. I mean, this was like the hottest wrestling ticket within the country.
They also had basically ceremonies all throughout the show to honor him.
Masafuchi was in the opener.
Oh, is that
right? Which is amazing.
Hiroshi Tanahashi wrestled on this card from New Japan.
Naomichi Marufuji, who has a really bad knee injury, but he was determined to work this show just because of its significance. And that goes alone to kind of make a statement.
As well as Yoshihiro Takayama. Basically, like, you know, real who's who of the Japanese wrestling scene, all turning out here to honor this guy. And even the former Japanese prime minister.
This is crazy. Yeah. Just imagine that happening. Imagine John Krechen going to the Ring of Honor show at Maple Leaf Gardens.
I don't see
in
that happening.
August.
I don't even see Bill Clinton ever appearing at a WrestleMania.
No, probably not.
No.
Unless they could convince him to do an angle with, like, the Bella Twins.
Oh, Bill Clinton versus or Bush versus Senior. How about that?
That would be a hell of a... Yeah. Anyway, so this match, it was highlighted by a lot of clever spots to kind of get the crowd really going for this. You had the tons of chops in this by Kobashi. Also doing a super long rolling cradle spot, just in how many rotations they went around the ring. I mean, the crowd was just loving this.
It was. And, you know, like, compare this to, okay, usually what? It's usually the head dropping spots that get this type of reaction. But, I mean, They're very smart with his limited ability, and to do something like this, I thought worked very well.
There is the definite argument to make that maybe some of these shortcuts could have been used more throughout his career.
Absolutely.
And that every night didn't have to be a complete, killing. And not that he, killed himself and had a kind of five-star match every single night. He certainly didn't. But, I mean, this is what pro wrestling is. It's finding ways to get the most reaction out of people, and hopefully at the end of it, by taking as little damage as possible.
Yeah.
And a rolling cradle spot, it sometimes can get the same reaction that an exploder to the floor can.
Sometimes, but we probably wouldn't be, talking about those matches with as much excitement if it was like all rolling cradle spots.
The finish did see Muto hit a moonsault, followed by Kobashi.
Man, Kobashi getting up there for that final moonsault.
I couldn't believe it.
I had a flashback to the wrestler and Randy the Ram.
Oh, Jesus.
Getting up to that top turnbuckle despite, having whatever his heart issues. And knowing that, God, if I do this, I might not survive, but fuck it. I'm going to do this anyway.
Jesus.
It's the last time I'll ever do it. And that's what this moonsault, this finish felt like.
Wow. Kobashi the Ram.
Sure.
Kenta the Ram. Hitting the moonsault and pinning Yoshinobu Kanemaru. And then the post-match just featured all eight guys in the ring posing for the crowd, doing a post-match ceremony. Kenta Kobashi thanking the crowd. People were crying throughout this. I mean, this was a really, really emotional scene, very much like the Ric Flair retirement.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And, throughout this match, I found that the young guys, Kenta, Kanemaru, Goshi Ozaki especially, they... I mean, here we have, what I'm perceiving as, almost like a broken down senior citizen in Kenta Kobashi. And yet these guys, Kenta Shiozaki, they weren't letting up at all on these kicks and these chomps. Like, they were chopping him as, fucking hard as he can. And no doubt they're doing that out of respect, because, if I don't, they probably know that, hey, Kobashi wants this. If I don't do it as hard as I can, treat you like, with some respect, then you're not going to be happy with me. So a lot of real emotion displayed, especially at the end, despite taking all these heavy chops and kicks, the Kenta, somebody, who's gone on to, pretty good success following his association with Kenta Kobashi. Kenta just coming in almost teary-eyed, kind of giving one last hug to his mentor. Some really, really nice emotion displayed here.
Yeah, and the crowd, I mean, they loved this, and I think they got everything they wanted out of this retirement match. It went 40 minutes. A tremendous send-off. I think one of the better send-offs you're going to see in pro wrestling.
Yeah, just like I said, a really gutsy performance from Kobashi. Like, at one point, I wondered if he can even pull off those machine gun chops anymore. They certainly weren't as fast, but they certainly were as abundant, and you can tell just the strain on the guy as he, continued to try to fit in, 15, 20 more chops in there on top of the 10 or 30 that he had already done.
Now, the natural question that comes with any wrestling retirement way is, do you ever foresee another Kenta Kobashi match? When all Japan needs a big match.
I'm really not sure how the Japanese treat retirement as opposed to North America. If this was North America, then, But then again, yeah, if this was North America, I'd say, yeah, he'd probably come back.
It's Tsuchi Onita. He has come back numerous times.
Right.
Well, I think he's done.
I think this was a great send-off, and the idealist in me, seeing how broken down his body is, would hope not. Because this was a very good send-off. I don't think he has anything more to prove. I don't think he has anything more to gain with another match. Certainly, he wouldn't be able to pull it off in a singles fashion to live up to the standard that he set.
Yeah, I'm with you. I hope that this is the last we have seen of Kenta Kobashi in the ring. So there you go. Those were our thoughts. Recapping four of his memorable matches of the dozens and dozens that you can check out online and see for yourself. So there you go. That was our review, Wei. And I think at this point...
I just want to say, I really enjoyed doing a review like this, because I feel like we just kind of lived through this man's life in, super fast forward, just to kind of get to see him, as sort of a rookie in his earlier... In his career, now all the way up until his last match. It was, it was really cool.
Yeah, I enjoyed this show quite a lot, just, being able to go to four very distinct matches within his career.
See this man, age into his peak, and then kind of his second win towards the tail end of his career, and then finally the end. It was like reading a really good synopsis.
Yeah, a lengthy synopsis too. We're getting into a record-setting time here on this week's review.
Wrap it up is what you're saying.
We're not wrapping it up. We still got an interview and feedback to go. We're going Broadway today. What would you like to do right now? Should we?
Let's go to WH Park.
All right. For those of you that are regular listeners here at Live Audio Wrestling, you will be familiar with our monthly show, Japanese Audio Wrestling, with Chris Charlton and WH Park, who do an excellent job every single month. Both men live in Japan, and WH, as I mentioned, the drug deal. Dealer of Japanese tape trading. I'm going to try and get that off the ground. But here he is, chatting with myself and Wei about the life and the career of one Kenta Kobashi. All right, we are joined now by WH Park, one of the men behind Japanese Audio Wrestling, which you can hear on this very site every single month with Chris Charlton. WH Park joining us. How are you?
I'm good. How's everyone back in Toronto?
Oh, it's springtime here, at WH, where the snow has disappeared momentarily, so it's looking like a decent spring over here.
I hear you guys are getting more earthquakes than I am here in Japan.
Yeah, we got a 4.8, but it was very uneventful. It was kind of like an addition of impact, without the literal impact. So, how about Japan, WH? Why don't you paint a picture for us over here? How things are over there in Numazu.
Numazu, yeah, it's great. Spring's been here for a while. Starting to get a little humid here, so I'm not looking forward to the summer as far as weather goes. I actually got this Sunday, New Japan Pro Wrestling is holding one of their Best of the Super Junior tournament cards in Numazu, so I'll actually be able to see New Japan Pro Wrestling without having to travel all the way to Tokyo for a change. So I'm really looking forward to that, and yeah, everything's good. Work's good. Life is good. I'm happy here in Japan.
Yeah, Numazu isn't usually a stop for them, is it? It's kind of a rare that they do shows there?
It's rare that anyone comes here. They're more likely to go to one of the bigger cities in the area, probably like Shizuoka City or maybe Hamamatsu. But it's nice when they come here. Dragon Gate has come here. I think All Japan has come here. But usually they come on days that I'm working, so I'm not able to go. So I really lucked out as far as the scheduling of this show because it's on a Sunday, which is my day off. So I'm looking forward to it.
Well, there you go. So I'm sure in the next edition of Japanese Audio Wrestling, WH will have a detailed report of New Japan coming to town. But today we are chatting the career of one Kenta Kobashi, which WH on the line here had a giant influence on showing me tons of stuff when I wanted to. When I initially was kind of just getting into Japanese wrestling and such, you were the one, WH, that was able to get a tape, I remember, of the Kobashi winning the GHC title from Misawa when everyone was talking about this match. And I remember one night at O'Grady's, you came in and you had the elusive VHS copy of this, and we watched it after Raw. And 10 years later, I remember that match a lot more than whatever happened on Raw that night.
Yeah, me too. I don't even know what happened on Raw that night.
Probably something similar to this week with Triple H looking very strong.
Probably.
But I guess what was kind of just tell us a bit about in the wake of the retirement match and just kind of all of the publicity that it has gotten. I know you'd posted a lot of pictures of some of the magazines that have been covering the retirement ceremony. Just overall, what's kind of the feel been like since the big Budokan Hall show just over a week ago?
People that know me, that know I'm a wrestling fan, keep coming up to me and saying, oh, someone famous retired, right? Yeah, and I'd say, it's Kenta Kobashi. Oh, that's cool. But it's like the only time, like really in the time I've been here that people ask me about wrestling. And it's because like his retirement got so much mainstream coverage because of who he was back in the 90s, and like he was one of the biggest stars in the boom period, and just from like because so many famous people went to Budokan to see his retirement match, that got a lot of press coverage as well, I think. So I'd say like as far as pro wrestling goes in Japan, this is one of the biggest mainstream stories that's happened in a long time.
What is the exact significance of the Budokan for Kenta Kobashi in particular?
Budokan Hall is probably the site of like his greatest matches and like the really for like any of those guys who are from All Japan in the 90s. So we're talking about Kobashi, Mitsuhara Misawa, Toshiaki Kawada, Akira Taue, and Jun Nakayama, and then other guys on the roster at that time. Budokan was the site of where they became stars, really. In Tokyo, the places to watch wrestling, there are three main places to watch wrestling, especially in the 90s. The first one being Korakuen Hall, because every company runs Korakuen Hall, Sumo Hall, and Budokan Hall. And Budokan was always All Japan's territory. And then when Noah formed and Masao and company split from All Japan, then it became Noah's arena. So you rarely ever see New Japan ever go there. They, as far as I know, they haven't gone there in like the last 15 years. All Japan can't run Budokan because they can't draw there. And Noah has been there since their inception, but they don't run it so much because of their own failings as a company creatively and financially. But this was a show that had to be held at Budokan just because of how important it was for Kobashi's own career, from the time he started in All Japan to his retirement in Noah.
And now that you've had a chance to see the match at WH, how did you think it came across as just in terms of a retirement match and what Kobashi was able to do in the match? They went about 40 minutes in this one.
I thought this is the best thing you could have done with him was to hide like his extreme like physical limitations. His knees are gone. Like he's just been racked with like cancer and all kinds of other injuries over the years. I think he should have retired maybe 5 years ago, and like when he was still kind of on top. But the match was fun. I thought it had a lot of significance because all the guys on the opposing side were guys he had a hand in training and kind of like taking under his wing when he was in All Japan in Noah. So you have Kenta, of course, Go Shizaki, Maibaki Taniguchi, and Yoshinobu Kanemaru. These are guys all like owe kind of large part of the success they've had to Kenta Kobashi. And then on his side, you had guys who were very closely affiliated with him, as far as being opponents and being tag team partners. So Muto and Kobashi, while they don't have like a lot of in-ring history with each other, I think it's been pretty common knowledge that they had a lot of respect to each other because they're kind of like what Muto was to New Japan at the time, Kobashi was to All Japan at the time. So they're like kind of analogs of each other in their respective companies. Sasaki is also someone who's very similar to Kobashi. Like they have very similar styles with the chops and the lariats and just being kind of power wrestlers. And they had that famous match in the Tokyo Dome, which I love. It's one of my favorite Kobashi matches, probably in my top five, where they just like had the epic chop battle for like, I think like 7 minutes straight almost, it seemed like. So it made sense for him to be joining Kobashi on his side of the tag team. And then of course his longtime rival and tag team partner, Jun Akiyama. Like I would have been completely flabbergasted if Akiyama wasn't involved in this match in some shape or form. But it was a fun match. I thought, you know, all the guys worked really hard. I think the star outside of Kobashi was Go Shizaki because he just like went in there and took a beating and just dished out as good as he got. So I was really happy for him because I've become a real big fan of his since he left Noah and formed the Burning Stable in All Japan.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Jun Akiyama there, and that was one of the other matches that we were discussing on today's show, was that huge match they had back in 2004, which was such a significant show for Noah, being able just to run the Tokyo Dome and how significant that was for the promotion. I mean, you had Kobashi, and it was funny looking back on things and just going back to read some stuff at the time that when they had first booked the Tokyo Dome, their initial idea was to do Kobashi against Bob Sapp on that show in the Tokyo Dome, and for whatever reason they couldn't put that together. But just part of me, this morbid curiosity, I would love to see that match of Kenta Kobashi and Bob Sapp.
That would have been interesting. I don't think, even as great a worker as Kobashi is, I don't know what he would have been able to get out of Bob Sapp, because I don't know what Bob Sapp would have been willing to take from Kobashi.
Oh, come on. You wouldn't have seen Sapp doing that exploder to the floor?
Maybe he'd, like, say, hold on a second, then just jump to the floor from the apron of his own volition and say, oh, let's just pretend you exploded me on there. But no, I think the best possible match he could have had was Kobashi and Akiyama or some kind of big-name outsider. But, yeah, that was a great match. It's like they just beat the crap out of each other in that match. It was had such an epic feel, and it was I think something that really helped establish Akiyama as a bigger star than he was before that match. So kudos to Kobashi. He's always been about like helping make new stars.
And it seems that was really, you know, the impetus behind Noah was when it launched. It was like, this is going to be, Akiyama is going to be our star. And it seems that almost, in almost any other era, I think Akiyama, would be regarded. And I think he will be as, you know, one of the great Japanese performers. But unfortunately, I think that his handicap was always kind of being in that shadow of Kobashi and Misawa, which was just, I don't care who you were, you weren't going to be able to necessarily live up to these just unattainable expectations. I think a lot of people had in terms of Akiyama reaching that level.
I think also he was kind of hampered by the style of Noah's booking, even though, like, he was the poster child that they were going to, like, okay, he's the guy outside of Misawa and Kobashi. He's the guy that's going to be the flagship of our company. He's going to be the guy we build around. He's going to be the GHC champion for a long time, where he's going to hold it a lot of times. But I think the thing is, like, Misawa couldn't escape, like, the booking mentality that he inherited from Giant Baba, which was, I gotta keep these guys on top for as long as I can. Even though he himself, like, Misawa was beat up, Kobashi was beat up, and they needed to put, like, Akiyama up there and create newer stars out of guys like Rikio and Morishima and all Kenta Marufuji. If you look at the last 10 years of their booking, they never fully pulled the trigger on people and, like, just stuck with him. They'd always be like, he didn't draw Budokan one time. We're going to take the belt off him. We're going to put it back on Misawa. We're going to put it back on Kobashi. We're going to put it on Tawei or something like that. And it just kind of, they shot themselves in the foot a lot. But yeah, I think, you know, the thing that always hampered Akiyama was he couldn't really escape the shadow of Kobashi and Misawa.
Hmm. Can you just briefly discuss sort of the ramifications behind Kobashi being let go of his contract with Noah, and you know, what the upper structure is right now within Noah, and what went behind that decision, and if there's any negativity towards the upper brass for that?
Oh yeah, Kobashi. From all I've heard, Kobashi hates the current owner of Noah, Ryo Nakata. A lot of what happened with Kobashi is a reaction to Nakata just firing all these guys that he felt weren't performing or drawing money for the company. And that's a very American attitude to have as far as, like, in a pro wrestling company. It's not the Japanese way of thinking. The Japanese way of thinking is, and this is something that, you know, Baba set up, especially in All Japan, was that you work for the company, we take care of you, and then we take care of you until you're ready to retire, or you get an office job, but you don't get fired. You're taken care of by the company. And then, so Nakata let go a lot of people in the company that he felt these guys aren't making us money because their finances were going down. And, like, I can't really blame him. If I was in his shoes, I probably would have done the same thing. So Kobashi's reaction to that was, like, to heavily criticize him publicly. And then, like, you know, Kobashi's had his own issues of injuries and illnesses that kept him out of the ring for a long time, and thus he wasn't making any money for the company, and he was the highest paid contracted wrestler in Noah. So it became a kind of, like, you know, do you keep Kobashi on as kind of a tradition thing, as a kind of perception, public perception thing, or do you cut your losses and say, okay, we got to let him go because he's not worth the money we're paying him? And they came to the conclusion we're going to let him go. So what happened from that was that Jun Akiyama, Go Shizaki, Yoshinobu Kanemaru, Kotaro Suzuki, and Atsushi Aoki all said, well, F you. You're firing him. We're leaving. We don't want to stay in this company anymore. I think there was a general unhappiness among those guys anyways with the booking and like how other wrestlers were treated, but that was kind of like the straw that broke the camel's back. So you had like five vital guys who could contribute in-ring-wise and draw money for you leaving, and now they're in All Japan, and you know, and they're doing pretty well in All Japan. I think they're responsible for like kind of maybe a surge of interest in that company. The last All Japan show I went to at Sumo Hall, you know, tons of people were cheering for the guys in Burning. A lot of their T-shirts were being worn by tons of people, including myself. If you watch All Japan's current TV, they get a lot of like pops when they come out. People cheer them, and they're so excited for these guys to be in there. And I think it was probably the best thing that happened to those five guys, because I don't think like they would have been doing anything remotely as significant in Noah as they are in All Japan right now.
It's almost like a reverse of what happened when, you know, Misawa and a number of people within All Japan were unhappy with the way All Japan was going, and then decided to leave, to form Noah, of course. But I wanted to also ask you, I mean, I also know that, Akira Taue and, Naomichi Marufuji are also part of, as president and vice president of Noah, part of perhaps the decision making to, unfortunately let, like, Kobashi go. Is there any animosity to be between those two and, Kobashi himself?
I haven't heard anything about that. I mean, you have to understand, like, a lot of times when wrestlers get office positions, it is really just kind of a figurehead. It's kind of, like, Taue, I don't really believe Taue has so much power where he could have gone to Ryu Nakata and said, listen, he's valuable to our company from a public perception point of view. Let's keep him. I don't think he had any kind of say in that. And I would assume Kobashi wouldn't, like, hold it against, like, either Taue or Marufuji. Marufuji being vice president is more, I guess, to recognize that he's the booker of Noah, or one of the bookers of Noah. They really don't have that much power, like, politically in the company as far as overriding, like, things that the owner wants to do. But I think if there was heat between Kobashi and those two, I probably would have read about it by now. So I would say probably not.
As we go back, just the one other match we were discussing was a six-man tag all the way back from 1990, and that was such an interesting year for All Japan because it was when Tenryu left the company, and it seemed that there was just this real initiative that we have to get this next generation up and going, and kind of Misawa, Kawada, and Kobashi were kind of part and parcel of that, with Jumbo Tsuruta, you know, working with all of these guys at that time. How influential was a Jumbo Tsuruta and kind of helping these guys get up, and that whole kind of 1990-ish transition as these three kind of young lions were kind of coming up in that All Japan structure?
I think, like, one of the things that really set All Japan on fire was the wake of Tenryu leaving All Japan to form SWS and then later War, and that, you know, Baba had to say, okay, well, yeah, I lost Tenryu and he took a bunch of guys with him. I need to elevate these younger guys sooner than I wanted to. And so to elevate them in Japan, and actually in any kind of form of wrestling, you need the established star to put them over. It's basic wrestling 101. And so Jumbo's feud with so basically, in that time period, you had one of the biggest programs in all of Japanese wrestling, and in all of wrestling, was Jumbo's Army, which included himself, Akira Taue as his tag team partner, I believe Yoshinari Ogawa as like kind of the junior heavyweight representative of the time, and then Masanobu Fuchi, who was part of the old guard. And they feuded with Misawa's Army, which included Misawa as the leader, Toshiaki Kawada as his second in command, Kobashi as kind of like that third guy who's up and coming, but he's not established as well as Misawa or Kawada, and then Tsuyoshi Kikuchi, who is like kind of the junior representative, and Kobashi's regular tag team partner. So yeah, this feud, and that manifested himself in multiple singles matches, multiple like tag matches, six-man tags, eight-man tags, just created like so many great matches. Like, I have a compilation back in Canada somewhere of like Jumbo's Army versus Misawa's Army, and I've watched it all. I think it was like 8 DVDs, and I watched every match, and they were all good. And just the excitement that you see in Korakuen Hall, the excitement in Budokan Hall and in other parts of Japan was just unreal. It's just they, you just don't see it anymore. And maybe the last time I saw it recently was Wabash match.
Sorry, well, you dropped out there, WH. Can you just repeat that?
Sure. So, like, the feud between Jumbo's Army and Misawa's Army was, like so instrumental in making Misawa, Kobashi, and Kawada, and then as well as Tawe, along with Yoshinari Ogawa and Tsuyoshi Kikuchi. Just the magnitude of the matches that they had in terms of, like, singles matches, tag matches, six-man tag matches, and eight-man tag matches just created so much excitement in for all Japan. And just the sheer number of great matches that you saw come out of that feud is just unreal. And I have a compilation of that program, and just every match was great, and just the heat for all those encounters from Korakuen Hall to Budokan Hall was just unbelievable and pretty much unmatched up until like maybe things like Kobashi's recent retirement match.
Mm-hmm. Before we kind of get on with some of the questions from listeners, I just wanted to ask you about, you know, All Japan, and specifically like late 90s All Japan, and how the whole advent of the whole head-dropping era came about. And I just wanted to get your thoughts on that. I mean, kind of knowing what we know now about what that kind of style does to people, what are your thoughts on it? Of course, at the time, it was incredibly entertaining, and but it did seem to have its negative repercussions as well. So what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, at the time, it was just you never saw anything like that happening in American wrestling. And New Japan wasn't really doing that kind of stuff. I mean, if you look at the differences of like New Japan promotes what they call strong style, and that's more about wearing down your opponent with like, you know, submissions and then like just striking. All Japan promoted what they called the King's Road or the Royal Road, and that was more like high impact moves. So at the time, yeah, it was exciting. It was like, oh my god, he dropped him on his head. Misawa used the Tiger Driver 91. Kawada just dumped Misawa on his head with that crazy pile driver. He made me wince at the time when I was watching that stuff. And nowadays, I don't really care for it. I'd rather people work the safer style, because you do see the effects on guys like Kobashi. I think, you know, a lot of his problems comes from working such a hard style, and it does shorten careers. And it does affect, like, their well-being and their health outside of wrestling. So, I care enough about, like, wrestlers that I don't want to see them, like, crippled, you know, by the time they're 42. And then, of course, the biggest, you know, negative about that style was what happened to Misawa. He died because he took a backdrop driver the wrong way. And if they never did that move, or they didn't do it as much, he might still be alive today. So, like, I am not a proponent of, like, the Noah style of head dropping anymore. And, like, it's part of the reason why I like maybe New Japan a bit more, because they don't work as dangerous a style as Noah, and to a smaller extent, All Japan still. But I do think, you know, at the time, it was exciting, but now we have to learn from that kind of the mistakes of that era, and especially in the wake of what happened with Misawa, that you should just kind of go get away from doing head drops and really dangerous like back suplexes.
Is there one particular match with Kobashi and Misawa that stands out above the rest to you? And also, do you kind of, because I also go back and, you know, I see some of those matches and, you know, they're classics to watch, but at the same time, you do have that kind of in the back of your head of these guys completely wrecked their bodies for this sport. And in Misawa, just, you know, an absolutely fatal price he ended up paying. But, just getting back to, just in terms of if there was one particular match between the two, because those two really did define each other's careers, it seemed.
They really had so many great matches against each other. I can't pick a specific date. Probably around 98. I can't tell you the exact month, but I think Kobashi was challenging for the Triple Crown against Misawa, and I think he lost. But, you know, like, they just busted out everything. Like, far as opponents for Misawa goes, like, the two guys that you could always count on having, like, an awesome, hard-hitting match that was just absolutely compelling to watch from start to beginning, from start to finish, sorry, was with Kawada and with Kobashi, because both of those guys were just willing to take it from Misawa, like, just take the Tiger Driver 91, get dropped on their heads by him, and he was willing to take all their offense as well. I couldn't tell you exactly, but probably, I'm thinking it's a match from 98. But my favorite match involving those two was actually when they teamed up against Taue and Kawada. It's like June of 96, I think. Mm-hmm. It's for the World Tag Team titles. Kobashi and Misawa are teaming against the Holy Demon Army of Kawada and Taue. And just, I think that match really, really elevated Kobashi a lot, because he was just willing to take so much punishment from Kawada especially. And there's a point in the match where, like, Kawada's just beating the shit out of Misawa, and just Kobashi comes in and covers Misawa's body with his own, and Kawada's like, what's going on here? And then he just starts punishing Kobashi, and you can just feel, like, the crowd just, like, they love Kobashi for sacrificing himself to save Misawa. And I think that's one of the biggest defining moments of Kobashi's career.
And we'll just go to one question here off of the message board. It was sent in, and he wants to ask if you thought that wrestlers such as Kobashi and Misawa are well known and revered because All Japan was so hot in the 90s, or do you think that it's more of a case that All Japan was succeeding because of wrestlers such like these? So I guess it's kind of your just philosophy, if it was the hot promotion that helped create these stars, or if it was the stars that made the promotion so hot. Kind of a tough question to answer.
I'd say the latter. I'd say, like, Misawa, Kobashi, Kawada, Taue, Akiyama made All Japan hot. I don't, like, Baba was, like, in big trouble when Tenryu left and he took a bunch of guys with him. If he didn't elevate these guys, if he didn't give them the ball, they All Japan wouldn't be around today. I can pretty much guarantee that. I think, like, they ushered in this new style of wrestling, and, you know, you can praise it or criticize it all you want, but they ushered in this new style of wrestling that just electrified wrestling fans in Japan, and just, because they'd never seen moves like this, they'd never seen wrestlers take punishment like this, and so, like, it just created a buzz among wrestling fans, and I don't think you'd be able to find another group of, like, four or five wrestlers who could encapsulate that and capture, like, this lightning in a bottle and just set the promotion on fire. It is more of a case those guys made the promotion, not the other way around.
Well, this has been awesome, WH. You've added so much context here to the show. And as we end off here, kind of just what are your personal memories going to be of, you know, just Kenta Kobashi's career, and maybe, you know, one or two moments that just immediately jump out as you think about him, and just the legacy he leaves behind here in Japan and worldwide, really?
For me, I started getting tapes of Japanese wrestling around 1995. Like, I finally discovered, like, newsletters, and the internet really ushered in this, like, oh, I can buy tapes from these dealers and watch wrestling from overseas, which I've always been curious about but never really had exposure to. So I started off primarily with New Japan. And then I met Dan the Mouth Lovransky, and he made a compilation for me of like New Japan and All Japan stuff. And then that was my first exposure to All Japan, was some of the tapes Mouth provided to me. And I just fell in love with like the All Japan style, and I was especially taken aback, like, oh, this guy, I read about this guy, he's Misawa, he's Kawada, oh, they're awesome. Who's this guy in the orange? Oh, this guy's Kobashi. He's just amazing. Like, just, he had, like, the spirit and fire that, like, Misawa and Kawada, as great as they were very stoic guys, but Kobashi had this fire in him that he just projected out, and I was immediately captured by him as a character and as a wrestler. And then just watching his matches primarily against Misawa just blew me away. Just like, you know, the creation of things like the Burning Hammer, his ability to do a moonsault being as big as he was, just like the intensity of his chops and his lariats just like blew me away. And like for me, like, probably the 98 match with Misawa, the 96 tag match against Kawada and Taue, his matches with Dr. Death Steve Williams. I think the first time you see the backdrop driver getting dumped on his head, that was the first time we ever saw it.
Yeah.
His match with Stan Hansen, where there's a lot of gifs of it, but the moment where Stan Hansen just lariats Kobashi, like Kobashi's sitting on the top turnbuckle in the corner, and Stan Hansen standing on the ring apron and just clobbers Kobashi right off of it. That match is awesome. Go out of your way to try to find Stan Hansen versus Kenta Kobashi. And then when they formed NOAH, he had some, you know, great matches with Misawa and Akiyama. And one of my favorite matches was against Kintsugi Sasaki in the Tokyo Dome. I think NOAH's second show.
Yeah.
In the Tokyo Dome. That's such a great match. Some of the stuff he did with the younger guys, particularly like Kenta, were really great. I think of the younger guys, Kenta was probably his best opponent. Because Kenta, more than anyone else in NOAH, probably owes his career to Kobashi more than anyone else. Just because, like, I think his, you know, matches against him where he just showed this spirit and I want to be a star, I want to go over you, just shine through, and people just latched onto that kind of sentiment that he was expressing. His influence is just, I don't think it can be measured. I think he's probably one of the most influential wrestlers in the entire world, in the last 20 years, more so than maybe some of the bigger stars you'll see come out of WWE. Or in New Japan, like anytime you see someone chop someone really hard, it's probably because they watch a Kenta Kobashi match. Like people doing lariats, Kenta Kobashi. Unfortunately, people doing head drops, probably Kenta Kobashi. So maybe that's not a good part of his legacy. But he was just a great. I'm glad he's retired because I think he'll be healthier. And he'll have a much richer life now. And he won't tarnish what was his legacy. I think he was in danger of doing that if he kept on going. So I'm really happy, like, that he's hung up his boots and he's going to, like, lead a healthier life and still be involved with wrestling because he's now the PWF president, another, you know, figurehead role. But he's going to get paid by All Japan and he's going to be hanging out with five of his like closest friends in the business, and I think he'll be much happier doing that in All Japan than he's been in the last 2-3 years in NOAH.
Well, WH, I want to thank you very much for staying up late in your time zone. And if you've enjoyed this chat, this is just a sample of what you can hear with WH and Chris Charlton. They do an awesome job every month with Japanese audio wrestling. I love listening to you guys every month. It's a fantastic show. And I'm not just saying that because you can get it on our website, which you can every single month. So WH, thanks as always, and love having you on. So we'll have to do this again sometime.
Yeah, thank you, John. Thank you. I really love talking with you guys about wrestling as much as I love talking with Chris as well every month.
All right. Well, we look forward to the next episode, and give WH a follow on Twitter at WHPark9.
So a big thank you to WH, and the next edition of Japanese Audio Wrestling will be up later on this month. So keep it tuned to liveaudiowrestling.com and the message board where we post all of those shows. And also there's all the archives are posted in the Law message board right there in episode archives. And you can go back and listen to past episodes of the show as well. So very easy to navigate. And we'll now head into the feedback that you guys left. And we got some poems, Wei.
Wow.
So let's start off here with Lee Russell, who writes, instead of gushing over Kobashi, which I very well could, I'm just going to throw out these haikus, one for each match. This might be some of the most creative feedback we've got. Yeah. For the first match, which was the six-man tag, Young Lion proves worth in there with the big boys now. Loss equals a win. Then we go to the Kobashi-Masawa match from January of 97. Two legends meet. Rivalry for the ages, a hour of pain.
These are really good.
Next up is the Tokyo Dome match with Kobashi and Jun Akiyama. Exploders, oh my, Kobashi is not human. Strong style burns bright. And finally, the retirement match, Kobashi's last match. Ring is awash in ribbons, the crowd in its tears.
Oh man, I'm sold. Wow. I want to watch these matches again.
This is feedback I enjoy.
I think every commercial, I wish every review in our feedback thread that we get from now on be told in haikus.
Yes,
because it would make things go a lot
for the wrestling audience. We should call them haikus.
Yes, sure. Yes, we can do that. All right, next we go to Pretty Tony, who says, I love, love, love that spot in the 97 Masawa match where Masawa counters the German by landing on all fours, immediately getting up to lariat a seemingly unsuspected Kobashi, only for that to get countered into an arm drag and arm bar. Amazing.
We go on to Dave from England with another poem.
Oh, you get all the poems.
Are you ready for this one?
Yeah.
You have to look ahead, Wei, and tell me at the end how to pronounce that last word. Kenta Kobashi, born in Japan as a result of a night of passion between Chuck Norris and Bruce Lee, he chopped his way out of the womb and delivered a burning hammer to the doctor for good measure. The man with more chops than a slaughterhouse who makes ice sculptures with his bare hands. Legend has it, when trees need felling, they call Kobashi. Seriously, though, what can be said about this man? The biggest underdog in the business, the best babyface in the sport, the greatest wrestler of all time. He can be all of these things. But let's not forget, he's a human being who paid the price. The hard-hitting style of Japanese wrestling has taken its toll. While I love this man's work and respect him immensely, it's good to see him end his career on his terms. It might not have been our preferred final one-on-one dream match, but I, for one, am glad he's moonsaulted his way into retirement as he did the hearts of the fans that watched him fight from beneath in great matches against Masawa, Tawe, Kawada, Akiyama, Sasaki, and Joe. This man is amazing. Enough said. Kobashi Kenta. Arigato
gozaimasu.
Yes. There you go.
Thank
you.
Not
as hard as I thought.
Well, that was really nice. Jake from the UK. To put it simply, Kenta Kobashi is a legend. From All Japan to Noah to ROH, he's produced some of the best matches in the history of pro wrestling. The four matches suggested by John Wei are a great sample of Kobashi, but really that's just the tip of the iceberg. He's not just a series of five-star matches. His whole career is worthy of that accolade. I love the match with Akiyama. Incredibly intense and some brutal spots, and it was made even better by Mauro Ranallo and the Meltzer commentary. His retirement match was such a spectacle as well, from the streamers before the match to the sheer star power on display throughout. Very enjoyable from start to finish. My lasting memory from that match will probably be when the cameras cut to a child with tears in his eyes. To me, this pretty much sums up what the man meant to wrestling and Japan in general. If anyone deserves retirement, it is one Kenta Kobashi. He has given his all to Japanese wrestling for well over two decades. The years of moonsaulting, head dropping, and fighting spirit have caused immense damage to his body. I'm glad he's made it out in one piece. Overall, he will go down as one of the best ever, and no one will ever match his incredible career. Thank you, Kobashi.
And finally, from George C., I really enjoyed watching these matches. The first match from 1990 was really good. It was very well booked and easy to tell the difference of the heels and the baby faces. Kenta Masawa and Kawada looked so young and energetic. The second and third matches were just amazing. Great storytelling and some really stiff work had me watching matches very intently. Kobashi's retirement match was sort of sad to watch. Seeing just how beat up he looks was really a downer. Then he barely climbs to the top rope and hits a moonsault for his finisher, and I almost choked on my beer. I popped so hard. Damn. Great job picking this array of matches. It really did a great job of showing a snapshot of his career. And thank you to all of you for your feedback, including the poems.
Oh, I love the poems.
Need more poems in wrestling.
Raps, anything. Be creative, guys.
Yes. And by the way, we forgot to do this on Review of Raw this past Monday, but on Friday, we are announcing a hell of a contest, aren't we, Wei?
I didn't know, are we?
I think
you
we are.
You didn't clear this with me.
Oh, you know what it is.
No, I don't, actually.
Well, you're going to have to tune in auto to...
Oh!
Yes, that one.
Okay.
It's a great contest.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Great potential.
Oh, I really look forward to this one.
And you know what? We're also... Yeah, we're going to announce that this Friday, so tune in, and we'll give you all the information there.
All right.
So that's going to wrap us up for a massive edition of Review Away. Thank you to all of you for tuning in, as well as Mauro Ranallo and W.H. Park for joining us. I think this was a pretty great, concise look. Well, not concise, but a great look at the career of Kenta Kobashi, and I would like to do more shows like this in the future where it's not necessarily an event, but we can also take a look at some guys' careers, because Wei, the undercard does a lot on Wei and his psyche.
It weighs a lot on...
Yes. I didn't make that pun.
Yeah, and leave your suggestions. What would you guys like us to review, maybe in this similar fashion? It could be maybe just a storyline, maybe it could be just anything to tie together a theme, and leave your suggestions in our feedback thread, which you can find at lawradio.proboards.com.
Yeah, and preferably guys that it would be fun to go back and watch stuff with, rather than like a career retrospective on Giant Gonzalez, for instance, that I don't know if we necessarily have to
fun.
Do. The El Gigante years and
my God.
Giant Gonzalez and then the Baywatch.
It's not the worst idea. In the world.
Yeah, it could be. All right, we're going to get on out of here. But next week, Wei, I'm going to ease us back into a wrestling show with, this past Monday, viewers left Raw with a lot of concern about one Triple H, mm-hmm. because he went off the air and people didn't know what had happened to Triple H. Is he going to miss time? A lot of uncertainty. And, you know, there was another edition of Raw where we left with a lot of uncertainty about Triple H, and that was back on May the 21st of 2001 in San Jose, California. One of the best matches in Raw history, and one where Triple H gutted his Wei to the finish of a match, and we were left with a lot of confusion and questions regarding the status of Triple H. So I thought we could go back and review that edition of Raw, which amazingly took place 12 years ago.
That's amazing.
And I remember that show as one of the hottest crowds for a Raw main event in history.
And I think to this day that is probably my favorite TV match, or at least my favorite match that ever on Raw.
And much like this past week, the attempt to create new stars and bring them up to the main event level. So let's see which one was more successful, as we will go back and review that Raw coming up next week on Review Away, and you'll be able to leave feedback up on the message board. Of course, we'll be back later this week with Review and Impact. The MMA report this week will feature TJ Grant, who's in action at UFC 160 this weekend, as well as Vanderlei Silva and MMAJunkie.com's John Morgan. And we've got a lot of stuff coming up this weekend as well. A UFC 160 post show, The Law featuring Chris Sabin, tons of stuff. What more could you possibly want, Wei?
To end this podcast.
All right.
I think we're nearing 3 hours right now.
We are getting into elusive territory here. So as we get on out of here, Wei, what is a song that can possibly put an exclamation point to the end of this Kenta Kobashi themed edition?
I'm guessing you've already played it off the top, but I mean, fuck it. So what? We got to hear one of the greatest entrance theme songs of all time. Grand Sword.
All right. Grand Sword is going to take us out. In the meantime, give us a follow at Law Radio, at Wei0937. Subscribe to Live Audio Wrestling on iTunes, and you can check us out at liveaudiowrestling.com. And we will chat with you next week as Grand Sword takes us out.